Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Jeffrey Dahmer is one of the most infamous serial killers of modern times. His name is synonymous with mutilation, necrophilia, and cannibalism.
You think of the crimes that he committed, they're so horrific, you kind of think only a madman or somebody totally evil, evil incarnate, would do this. But when you talked with Jeff Dahmer, you just did not get this idea. He could be engaging, he could be bright, witty, he could make jokes. He was able to fool a lot of people.
People that worked with him had no idea that he was a violent man. This was part of the real danger of Jeffrey Dahmer. He could join you or me at lunch, and no one would detect that he was a violent person.
Jeffrey Dahmer, on the surface, was not an abnormal-appearing individual. He was fairly good-looking. He was well-spoken. He was articulate.
Never in a million years would I have guessed a homicidal maniac.
To me, he's always been really a tragic figure, which is kind of hard for a lot of people to understand. But I don't really think of him as, you know, the serial killer monster. I just think of him as this kid who was spiraling out of control and nobody stopped him.
How good was Jeff at manipulating you?
Excellent. He's very good.
Good liar?
He fooled everyone. He fooled me. Yeah, very good. He fooled his probation officer, his attorney, the police, you know, who came. I mean, he had bodies in his next room when the police were standing in his outer room. There were so many people that he fooled.
And he could lie and be cool as a cucumber.
Yeah, he just looked very innocuous. He just looked like an average person who couldn't possibly do the things that he did.
Dahmer began to construct fantasies of sex with dead or unconscious men.
Dahmer told me that on one occasion he had seen in the newspaper an account of a young man who was killed on a motorcycle, and he fell in love with the individual just from the photograph. He actually went to the funeral home to view the corpse, but he became so aroused that he excused himself into the bathroom where he masturbated.
If this whole thing is conjecture at this point. It might have been, along with other incidents in his lives, might have been one of the trigger points. I mean, you know, the old Freudian castration complex might come to bear here, and I guess psychoanalysts would really have a heyday with this, because, you know, he was concerned about losing his penis. He asked his mother if he had lost it, if it had been cut off. Now, they
made something he later did to his, or at least some of his victims.
That's true. Yes.
Was it the killing that excited you? Or is it what happened after the killing?
No, the killing was just a means to an end. That was the least satisfactory part. I didn't enjoy doing that. That's why I tried to create living zombies with muriatic acid in the drill. But it never worked. No, the killing wasn't the objective. I just wanted to have the person under my complete control, not having to consider their wishes, being able to keep them there as long as I wanted. It's not easy to say that, but that's what the motive was.
Where did that need for control come from? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. Maybe I felt I had no control as a child or young adult, and that got mixed in with my sexuality, and I ended up doing what I did was my way of feeling in complete control, at least for that situation. creating my own little world where I had the final say, finding the best looking guy that I could, and having total mastery over him for as long as I wanted. Lust played a big part of it, controlling lust. That was the motive right there.
Where did sex enter in to the killings, Jeff?
It was a big part of it. My only objective was to find the best looking guy that I could. Their sexual preference didn't matter to me.
Did their race matter to you?
No, their race didn't matter to me. The first two young men were white. The third young man was American Indian. The fourth and fifth were Hispanic. So no, race had nothing to do with it. It was just their looks.
Was there something sexual in the dismemberment of the bodies for you?
As time went on, yes, I did get there was a sexual part to that. I started saving the skeletons and preserving other parts. And one thing led to another. It took more and more deviant type behaviors to satisfy my urges, and so it just spiraled out of control.
Why the cannibalism?
It made me feel like they were a permanent part of me. Besides the just mere curiosity of what it would be like, it made them feel that they were a part of me, and it gave me a sexual satisfaction to do that. The only motive that there ever was to completely control a person that I found physically attractive, and keep them with me as long as possible, even if it meant just keeping a part of them.
Dusty Renegade Justice, in for another program of The Cows. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the broadcast. Hope it is a constructive investment of your time and energy. Today's date is Tuesday, December 13th. We are on location doing The Cows. Always interesting doing programs during a road trip. But hopefully it'll be constructive. I'm really excited about today's program. This broadcast, all about perseverance. I've been hoping to do a broadcast to kind of cover, do a case study, if you will, of serial killer, necrophiliac, cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer for some time. And I had been in contact with our guest for today's program and hoping that we could get him on the program to discuss the biography that he wrote Jeffrey Dahmer. We finally, a lot of emails and Facebook messages, and finally, I think it's taken about a year and a half, but finally able to make it happen. He actually is an attorney, so it'll be very interesting to hear his perspective on what happened with Jeffrey Dahmer. Our guest for today's program, in addition to writing the book, The Milwaukee Massacre, on Jeffrey Dahmer, he also, as I said, is an attorney. Our guest for today's program, a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin, the National Association of Criminal Lawyers, the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin. Our guest, his practice is concentrated primarily in criminal law, and as I said, very much a pleasure to get his perspective based on his research and what he's written about the life, death, and I guess murderous rampage of Mr. Jeffrey Dahmer. Joining us live for today's broadcast, our guest, Mr. Robert J. Dvorak. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. Mr. Dvorak, are you with us, sir?
Yes, Gus.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly? I just wanted to double check on that.
Dvorak is close enough, yeah. Bob is good. You can call me Bob.
Okay, so it's Dvorak.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Would you prefer Bob, or does it matter?
Bob is fine. It's less pretentious.
We will do Bob. Thank you again for sharing some of your time with us, sir. I guess anything you would like to let our listeners know before we begin?
I'm actually writing a book right now about a serial sexual predator. And I see some similarities in the case with Jeffrey Dahmer because it is about power and control with people who do these things. It's not about sex. It's about power and control. And Jeffrey Dahmer killed the physical body. This sexual predator will kill a soul.
I guess, can you just elaborate a little bit the difference in terms of the difference between killing a body and killing a soul and what that entails to kill someone's soul?
Well, if you're a grown man and you're preying on young boys and who don't know really the difference between right or wrong at that point or being able to say no, it destroys something inside the human body. Without, you know, it's not murderous, but it really is a horrific crime. And it involves the Penn State scandal, by the way.
Why, are you writing your new book? Is it going to deal with what happened at Penn State?
Yes.
Wow. I would love to have you back on the program when that is all done. Do you have a estimated time of when you're going to be done with that?
It's a quick deadline because it's, you know, it's so fresh and the trial's not going to be probably till August. I would expect to have the book out by March.
Wow. What's the title of it going to be?
I haven't decided on that yet. We're still in discussion on that, but it's a crime book. Obviously, it's a book about a crime, and then this terrible cover-up that brought down the most famous football coach in history and an entire university administration. And along the way, tarnished the reputation of a pretty good school, and a lot of people got caught in the middle of it. So a lot of themes in there.
Wow. I will definitely make sure we're on the lookout. I would be interested in reading that once it's all done. I guess real quick, just on the Penn State thing, do you have information with regards to Mr. Sandusky's victims? Do you know whether or not the victims were any of them black? Were they most black? Do you know anything about the racial composition of the victims?
I do. My understanding is that most, if not all of them, were black. That was maybe one of the things that played a role in this, and I say that in the sense that it made the crime more invisible. That if these had been white boys aged 10 to 12, 14, that I think somebody would have noticed quicker.
Wow. Do you see any parallels in that regard to what happened with Jeffrey Dahmer? Because a considerable number of his victims were also black and or non-white.
Right, and I heard him talk about he was looking for a certain type. And I think the difference is, with Dahmer, his victims were also on the edges of society, the fringes. For example, if they showed up missing, nobody would know about it for a while, or nobody would be in a position to call authorities because they could have been a runaway or somebody living an underground existence. When they turned up missing, no alarms went off because they were kind of missing anyway. And with Sandusky, you have the vulnerability of these boys, and they are children. They're children who may have come from an abusive household, abusive father, or their mother's working two jobs to work in a to pay the rent in a housing project, and they don't have anything to do. They're from the wrong side of the tracks, that some people would say. But they need some structure in their life, and they're recommended to a charity called the Second Mile. And this guy's using his charity to target victims. It's incredible.
Wow. Again, our guest, Robert J. Dvorak. We will be looking out for the new book on what happened at Penn State.
I wanted to ask you, Gus, did you think I was a lawyer from Wisconsin? Because I'm a journalist from – I was living in New York City at the time when I wrote the book.
Does someone else have your same information? Are you – you're not an attorney?
No. Nothing wrong with the attorneys, although okay. Shakespeare said that we should kill all of them, but that's a new
thing. Okay.
I'm a journalist.
Okay.
I was a journalist for 44 years, and I just got bought out from my newspaper job, so I'm writing on my own now.
Okay. I will correct that. My apologies. That was someone has your exact name, and they look like you. They had a photograph.
That's too much to think about right there.
Wow. Okay. I guess you want to give the corrected biography for our listeners, since you're a journalist, not an attorney. My apologies, folks.
Right. I worked for 44 years as a journalist, including 20 years with the Associated Press, and for 8 years I was based in New York City as a national writer. So I covered things from earthquakes, hurricanes, Desert Storm, the first Oklahoma City bombing, the first World Trade Center bombing, things of that sort. And now I live in Pittsburgh now, and I work for the Post-Gazette, and I covered Super Bowls and Stanley Cup championships and World Series.
Okay. Right on. My apologies, folks. Glad we got that corrected.
And like I said, to all my lawyer friends, there's nothing wrong. I just can't pass myself off as a lawyer if I'm not. You know, I don't want to misrepresent myself. So.
I respect that. Okay. our guest, journalist, author. Right on. Admirable profession. Admirable profession.
A dead one, too. But.
I guess with just starting with the very beginning, I think a lot of people know the grisly headlines about Jeffrey Dahmer, and he's a cannibal, and the horrific things that he did. Is this guy sane, in your opinion? Research that you've done, do you think this guy was crazy, or do you think he was sane?
I think that takes a judgment. But in my own view, as I was doing the book and I started to write it, I had an epiphany one night because I looked at how Jeffrey Dahmer operated, what was going on in his life, and I actually understood what the guy was thinking when he was doing it. And it was like, well, wait a minute, he can't be insane. But his wires were all crossed. I thought he was, in my opinion, I'm an amateur. A psychiatrist could study this case for years and come up with a different opinion. I thought he was sane. He was just able to project an image of himself that allowed him to operate in the real world when actually he was driven by these incredibly dark secrets, these dark fantasies of his.
Dark fantasies. Wow. Wow. For folks who are listening or didn't follow the trial, he was, during the trial, declared legally sane, even though
Correct.
I guess that's something that's disputed. People have their different opinions. You, just according to your opinion, you think he was sane, just your opinion?
Right, I do, because, you could talk to him, you could have a conversation. He wasn't deranged. He didn't act strangely, in the sense that he stood out in any way. The greatest thing about Jeffrey Dahmer, in my view, was that if he was in the same room with you and I, you wouldn't even recognize him. He could blend in that well. He was non-threatening. He didn't look. He kept a certain appearance that was neat and acceptable. And if you and I were in the same room, you wouldn't notice him. But he could pick out people that he knew he could deal with. Is that evil? It's sure, I'll leave that to the listeners to decide.
When you say he could pick out people that he knew he could deal with, I presume that you mean people. He was very good at being able to pick out people he knew he could victimize. Can you kind of elaborate on that? Like, how was he able to do this?
And he could tell in 15 seconds. It could be a gleam in the eye. It could be a certain way they carried themselves. It would just be sort of like an aura. But it's that's how predators work. They can pick up on whatever it is, a vibe, a scent, or whatever else. They can tell that I see this person. He's has a certain look. I know I can get him to come back to my place tonight, and I'll tell him a story, and before you know it, I'm not going to let him go.
Wow. Wow.
That is scary, because there are people like that out there that are, you know, it's sort of like, and it's, I don't want to use a bad analogy, but a pickpocket would find somebody with an open coat or somebody who was distracted and be able to lift a wallet out. I mean, you wouldn't go up to a cop and try to lift his wallet, but thieves know a certain look to go after, and these serial killers, these serial criminals, their radar works differently than yours and mine.
Fascinating. I guess one of the main things I wanted to get to, you and we've already touched on it to some degree. You said this guy, Jeffrey Dahmer, he could be in a room. If he was in a room with us, he would blend right in. You wouldn't think this guy, I don't want to say crazy, but you would not think that this guy is a murderous cannibal. That would be the last thought in your mind. How do you think he was able to fool so many people? His dad, I heard his parents, they both said they had no idea. He was stopped by enforcement officers several times. How was he able to function so well amongst people to avoid detection?
Quick learner. And, you know, I think the parents both had issues that played into his personality, to be honest with you. But you're right, he could project an image of himself that was the exact opposite of what he was really feeling inside. Two police officers come to your door and say, well, we heard a report that somebody, he said, no, he's with me, he's my boyfriend, and it's a 13-year-old Asian kid. I mean, it's incredible. And then while he's telling them this, there's seven bodies in his freezer and a head in the refrigerator. It's mind-boggling. But then again, you know, he was he thought of himself as possessed by the devil. I don't want to – if I did a follow-up to the book, I would say, you know, he was killed in prison because he asked to get into the general population. And he knew that by asking to get in the general population that somebody was going to get rid of him. He couldn't live with himself anymore, and he wanted to die. And the person who bludgeoned him to death with a barbell pipe thought of himself as the embodiment, was thought of himself as the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. So you had Jeffrey thought he was possessed by the devil, and you have this biblical thing of good over evil, that a guy who thought he was Jesus Christ killed the devil in prison.
The irony, I know several people have pointed this out. He was, Jeffrey Dahmer, he was bludgeoned to death with a barbell, which is the same way that Jeffrey Dahmer, murdered his first victim
right,
so many years ago.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you don't underestimate what his words when he said he wanted total control. He didn't want them to leave him. Everybody who he ever knew in his life that he cared about left him. His mother left him at some point. His father left the house at some point and married somebody else. He's left all alone to fend for himself. So afraid of being left alone that the only way he could make sure that he could have a friend forever was to kill them and consume part of the body so that he would have their power, that they would exist in him.
The cows, I guess, again, Mr. Robert Dvorak, it seemed like he had this skill with words for a long time and being able to use words to manipulate people, as you said, to kind of project whatever image of himself that he wanted others to have. I saw reports even when he was in high school, I think they took a field trip to D.C., and he was able to call up the vice president at the time, Walter Mondale, and navigate some sort of interview where he got his class in to speak to them. Just being able to use words. I mean, to me, that is just stunning. Somebody to do all these crimes and to be so slick and silver-tongued with their ability to use words that they can manipulate anyone.
Absolutely. They're very persuasive, and they have this uncanny ability to project whatever it is you want to see. It's like one of those Star Trek holograms or something. He would use words, conversations, a look, and to be honest with you, and it's kind of hard to say, but some of these people pick themselves. Where they would pick out Jeffrey Dahmer. They would approach him because, okay, here's a decent-looking guy and decent clothes, and he's at a place where I'm at, and, you know, I'm looking for a good time, and before you know it, you ended up in Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment watching The Exorcist 3, and he's got the drill out trying to turn you into a zombie.
Jeez.
Yeah, and that was his point about trying to turn them into zombies, you know, to put a Black and Decker drill bit into somebody's temple and pour acid in it and think that they're going to keep them alive. But he wanted them to be kept alive, but not able to function enough to walk out that door, so that they would always be there, and he would always have control over them.
Oh, zombies, folks, zombies. I when I'm doing my research, I was pretty young when the whole Jeffrey Dahmer thing was front page news. When I started doing my research and preparing for the program, I had no idea that Dahmer had come in contact with enforcement officers so many times during his killing spree. The night of his first murder, he gets stopped by the enforcement officers. They give him a ticket, let him go. He's got a body in the vehicle. Years later, he gets arrested. Child molestation of a 13-year-old. He's already killed several people. They don't know anything about that. They put him on probation. His probation officer doesn't even follow up with him. How does he have so... the later episode where one of his victims escapes and an enforcement officer escorts the victim back to Dahmer's apartment. How in the world did enforcement officers, the police, continue to miss this guy?
And I have the utmost respect for what police officers do and the commission of their job. They put themselves on the line to try to protect us from criminals. A police officer is like a soldier on patrol. You see what you want to see. If you pull somebody over for a parking ticket, but they're polite and they say, "Yes, sir, how can I help you?" and they're non-threatening, well, if you're complying with everything this officer wants you to do, then the officer kind of relaxes, and he doesn't suspect or doesn't look around or doesn't notice the smell coming from your bedroom from the 55-gallon drums of acid. It's just one of those things where if you're a disarming personality and not threatening, even to a police officer, you have a real good chance at talking your way out of something.
Do you think, just based on what you said, officers, and I think people in general see what they want to see oftentimes, do you think because Jeffrey Dahmer was a white person, a black person, that aided his ability in dealing with enforcement officers and them, for example, them not checking his vehicle that night, even though he's got a body in the car, and them walking one of the victims back to his home, do you think that helped him in evading enforcement officers, the fact that he was not a black person, the fact he was a white man?
Excellent question, Gus, and I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that, but I will say this. If he were black, he would have been stopped earlier, and because he was white, he was able to move more freely in that underground world. As he said, one of his, the third victim was a Native American, a runaway. There were Hispanic kids. There were black kids. The first one was white. It wasn't all about race with him, but race did play a factor in the sense that it allowed him, it gave him cover. Sort of like with, you know, I go back to Sandusky with, if all of his, it's 11 people have come forward now, are either black or mixed race, it gave Sandusky cover because, this nice white man helping out these poor, disadvantaged black kids. You know, that's the way our society is, unfortunately.
Appreciate the honesty, sir.
Like I said, I worked as a journalist for 44 years, and you ask me a question, I'm going to tell you what I think, and I just don't think there's any way around it, that race plays a factor in this, and pretty much plays a factor in almost everything that happens in America. It's our national challenge.
The cows. I didn't want to miss that because you said earlier you think that his parents and perhaps their upbringing or some of the things that happened in the household, that had an impact on what Jeffrey Dahmer did later in life. What impact do you think the home environment and his parents had on his behavior?
I think it was crucial that when his younger brother was born and his mother came home from the hospital with postpartum depression, and it was all of a sudden when the mother went to the hospital, Jeffrey still had a mother. When she came home, he didn't have a mother anymore. She had emotionally distanced herself from him totally, but not with the younger one. And she actually moved out of the house and moved away. So now he's left alone with a father who actually commutes to work in Pittsburgh, lives during the week in Pittsburgh. And you're a teenage, adolescent boy living by yourself at home without any parental control, supervision, or anybody to, you know, say, oh, Jeffrey, did you have a tough day, or can I help you with your homework? He was abandoned. He was left alone to his own devices. And I think to his peril, because it really twisted and warped his mind. And don't forget his father had a role in his modus operandi when his father was a chemist who showed him that you could melt the flesh off of dead animals by dropping it into a vat of acid and coming back a few days later and all the flesh is gone. You're left with a nice-looking skeleton. So he knew how to dissolve flesh and get rid of evidence because his father taught him how to use chemicals.
Wow. Wow. That's right. His dad, a PhD chemist, a lot of the techniques and things that he used, it seems evident that he had some understanding of chemistry and how to do things with those. I saw doing my research, he spent some time, he was a field medic when he joined the services. Do you think he used some of the training that he picked up as a field medic as well when he went to carving and manipulating these corpses?
He had a definite understanding and knowledge of the human anatomy, the anatomy of how things work in a dying fish or a dog that was killed alongside the road. Yes, he did, and that came, I think, probably from several sources, but that's as good a place as any to start.
Wow. Do you make anything? I know it's talked about a lot, him when he was younger, you know, when he was a child, him taking dead carcasses, roadkill, taking that home, dissecting it, and saying that somehow that ended up being attached to his sexual urges, and particularly repressed homosexual urges. Do you make anything of that, and how that perhaps impacted his conduct later on?
Yeah, and again, I'll qualify it by saying I'm no expert on this, but he was doing these things like getting dead animals and doing and dissecting them. At the time, he's going through adolescence and puberty when his sexual hormones are kicking in. So there was definitely a crossover. The wires got rearranged because the sexual urges were all part and parcel of what he was doing. I think I heard one of the sound clips where he said he got so aroused at going to somebody's funeral. As sick as that sounds, as bizarre as that sounds, it's definitely true. His wires got crossed. His sexuality and his fascination with death were merged.
Do you think this could have been, exaggerated if he had these homosexual urges and he was trying to repress that or felt that that was something that was incorrect? Do you think that in any way contributed to his dysfunction?
You know what? He did. I know he went to at least the high school prom, but I think he had an aversion toward women that stems from his mother. I don't want to get too Freudian or talk about any Oedipus complexes here, but I thought he found it easier to be in a room with males, and if that explains his sexuality, fine, but I think he was just more comfortable in the company of men, and that's why he chose men as partners.
Hmm. Fascinating. I'm just trying to, I'm studying. This is a, just an incredible case. I heard his father say that he had a fear of losing his penis, I guess going back to that Freud thing, of losing his penis when he was younger, or his penis being cut off. And the interviewer pointed out, hey, he did do that to many of his victims, removing their genitals. Did you come across this in your research? What do you make of this, him as a child saying he has some sort of fear of being castrated or losing his genitals?
Yeah, no, I didn't get that part in the research I was doing for the book, but I do know that he kept severed genitalia in jars in his bedroom closet. He definitely did do that. And there was some maybe difference of opinion that he was trying to capture somebody else's manhood by that. But if that came from a phobia of losing his own, let me tell you, I can't speak to that directly, but it would not surprise me, especially if it came from the father. He would know.
Wow. Yeah, that one of the clips at the beginning, his father, and they have a lot of documentaries on his father, his mom, Jeffrey Dahmer himself, where they share more information. Just that alone, when I heard that, it stood out to me, being someone I spent a lot of time investigating racism. The long track record, I'm sure you are aware, I think most people are, the long track record of black males in this area of the world being lynched and castrated. And then Jeffrey Dahmer removing the genitals of a lot of his victims, and many of them black males. It was surprising that I didn't hear more people making that connection and saying, wow, maybe there's more of an element of racism to this case than we've been thinking at first. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think you're really on point there, that there is some connection. Unfortunately, we don't have him to ask directly anymore, do we? So that may remain one of the mysteries of the whole thing.
Wow. I've mentioned it on the program repeatedly, the concept of necrophilia, and I think this is the first time I've ever actually heard a person where everyone has pretty much said, yes, this is someone who is a necrophiliac, he's suffering from necrophilia, and he's practicing it. Can you kind of explain that concept and if Jeffrey Dahmer qualifies for necrophiliac?
Well, here's what I understand through my research and through the writing. He would use the sleeping pill Halcyon in connection with a rum and coke. So a sleeping pill and the alcohol, and the a person would be out, unconscious. Then he could do with them whatever he wanted to. And part of what empowered him was being able to control somebody else when they were unable to respond because they were either unconscious or about to be dead. And there was, it's so bizarre to try to comprehend how this happens, but there are these sexual acts where as you're squeezing the person's last breath out of their body, the orgasm is heightened, those kinds of things. But I think he did it for control. They couldn't run away. Then after they were drugged or maybe, whatever else he did with them, with the acid and the Black and Decker drill, that they would end up dead. He would kill them, strangle them, or feel that last breath coming out of their throat, and feeling the power because he took that. He took that life. But then, after a necrophilia operates, you have to get rid of the evidence. You can't keep it forever. So the paradox there, he wanted them to keep them forever. They couldn't run away, but because they don't last forever, he had to get rid of them anyway.
Wow. He's keeping, I just want to check with you, you wrote the book on this subject. He's keeping genitals, mummified heads, body parts, and what have you. He's keeping some of these things, it seems to me, as trophies. He's got some of the stuff in his work locker. Is that accurate? Is that your understanding?
Gus, you used the exact right word, trophies. He kept something from every one of them. And whether it was a part or, you know, the way you would collect a souvenir. If you went to a concert that you liked, you'd save the ticket and say, I remember when I went to see this. Or to a sporting event, and you say, it was a big deal. I got to go to the Super Bowl. I'm going to save my ticket. He would save something from every one of them as a trophy and a reminder, which all goes, again, back to possession and control, that by keeping that one little thing of somebody, one little thing, a head, a skull, genitalia in a jar, he was able, that meant you were his forever, that he could hang on to you that way.
Wow.
And the word you used, trophy, it was a trophy. It was, what's another poor analogy? It was somebody who goes out and shoots a deer and they get the head mounted and it's on the wall. It's not a pretty deer anymore, but it's a trophy that they had mounted. He considered them trophies.
Wow. What, I guess if you know, what was he looking to get? Because he didn't, some of these, he actually ate the cannibalism aspect. What is it that he thought he was getting from consuming, I think some of it was the bicep or muscle from the thigh area or even the flesh in some instances. What did he think he was getting by consuming the bodies of his victims?
Right, it had nothing to do with, nourishment or hunger. By consuming them, they would always be part of him. That he ingested human flesh, that means that you're now part of me and you're going to live with me forever. There are some ancient cultures who abide by such practices, but for his part, it was all about possession and control of a human life. And by consuming their parts, their flesh, they became part of him. He owned their spirit now.
Wow. So that goes back, just remembering, you said earlier in the conversation there's a difference between killing a body and killing a soul. You think this, the cannibalism aspect, that is the part of, possession of the person's soul. Your soul is now part of me. Is that, am I understanding you correctly?
Wow, you just, that opened my eyes on something. Actually, that's true. If a sexual predator is with someone, they don't kill them. Actually, they want them around more and more, but for the person who this stuff is done to, it completely destroys their sense of self, their sense of worth, their sense of morality or trust, that's all been broken, that's all been stolen, and you don't trust anybody else ever again, and you carry around this guilt and shame and dirtiness, this hole in your heart forever. So, I shouldn't say forever, because there are many instances where sexual abuse victims who have sought help and got interventions were able to deal with it and go on to lead productive lives. So they got their souls back. Unfortunately, a lot of them who this happens to, and they just never can deal with it, they commit suicide and get out early. They just can't live with it. So in a sense, when you kill somebody's soul, you can also kill their body. If you kill somebody's body, you can also kill their soul.
Wow. Again,
what's your fascination with all this? I mean, it's sort of like, it's a horrible story. It's an awful, despicable, vile crime, and yet people want to know more, and like the train wreck that you can't turn away from. You just, but the bottom line of it is it's real. It happened. I didn't create these people. I didn't create these situations, but they happen, and if you don't document them and write them from start to finish and sweep it under the rug, then you're just complicit with how the guy operated in the first place.
I agree totally. I agree totally with that. you asked the question, my fascination. Truthfully, as I said, I was a lot younger when this happened. I really wasn't old enough to really grasp it. I'm kind of glad my parents didn't allow me to see too much of this when it all happened. But only recently did I become interested in this, and it was because of racism. I didn't know that a disproportionate number of his victims were black males, and I think the bulk of them, I think all except for three, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I think all except for three of his victims were non-white. He had quite a few black males, Native American, a couple
Hispanic.
The race aspect, not only in what you touched on earlier, and unless my understanding is flawed, when he was arrested in Ohio, child molestation of a 13-year-old, he was released early, and he was on probation. I saw reports where probation officer never followed up on him. Never. Mm-hmm. That is astounding to me as a black male. I just cannot fathom.
Well, you know, it offends me. If we have these people set up in these positions to check on people on who are on probation, and they're too overwhelmed and they don't have the resources, then what are they there for? What are we doing? And to just allow this to go on, you know what it does? It serves to encourage the person to do more and more and more. It's a testing of the boundaries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just since you brought up at the very beginning, you're working on the new book on what happened at Penn State. To me, it gives me a better, just the research that I've done on this case and preparing for the program, it gives me a better understanding of how something like what went down at Penn State, how that can happen, because it seems to be a pattern. We really do not take child molestation very seriously. It really does not seem to be a top priority. They didn't even follow up with Jeffrey Dahmer. What happened with Jerry Sandusky? There was an investigation in 1998, no charges filed. This just goes on and on and on for another, I guess, 13 years. It just seems that, you know, this is really not that big a deal. And especially if the victims happen to be black, nobody who will be missed.
I think there's a certain element of denial, too. If you tell an Italian Catholic from Brooklyn who was schooled by Jesuits, and you say, hey, your most trusted aide, your heir apparent, has been having sex with 10-year-old boys, and he'd say, oh, no, I don't want to hear that. I can't process that. I think in Joe Paterno's case that he was unable to even process the heinous nature of these crimes, but when he kicked it upstairs, which he did his bare minimum under the legal requirements to do, when he kicked it upstairs, then I think the cover-up took effect. So there were like two different elements at work there, but both of them served to push the crime under the into the muck deeper and deeper, and when it finally did rise up and explode, this is like a dirty bomb all of a sudden.
Wow, do you think this is with the what happened at Penn State? Do you think it's possible that part of the reason that this was covered up is because there were other individuals involved besides Sandusky? And when I say involved, I mean other perpetrators.
No, this guy would act on his own. He couldn't function with adults, but he could function in the kids' world. He lived in a different world. If he tried to do this with anybody else, or he was partnered with somebody else, it would have been, it just would never have worked. He was, he's what you call the lone hunter. He was out there by himself. And no, I don't think there was any kind of conspiracy. But one of the tragic things is the guy sets up a charity to help underprivileged kids, which merely serves as, it's the fox who built the hen house, and he can pick and choose as these kids come through. And I think as long as he's been around kids, he's been doing the same thing, but he's always been around kids.
Did you see his, Jerry Sandusky I'm talking about, his autobiography, Touched, that's the title of it?
Yeah, that's going to be one of the all-time worst titles ever picked for a book by the author, isn't it? But there are a couple of phrases, a couple of points that stuck out with me in there. One is that pretending has always been a part of my life. He wrote that in his autobiography. He wrote, I've always lived part of my life in the, I've always lived my life in the world of make-believe. He was almost admitting he's lived in this fantasy land. And just a couple other real insightful telling points. Not enough to ever call attention to himself, because don't forget, this book is about the great work he's done with underprivileged children and how he loves kids, and he's a kid himself. And you could never connect the dots because, well, a whole number of factors. But anybody who had a chance to help these kids by stopping Sandusky blew it. And they're going to have to deal with that as they go to their graves.
Looking like more and more people complicit in that cover-up. I guess, do you, or I'll ask it this way, I'll say it this way. When I first heard about his autobiography and the title Touched, and some of the passages that you read, him, his love for pretending and living in a world of make-believe, what I found most astounding about that was the fact that that autobiography was published at least 2 years after there had been an investigation. And
right.
They decided not to file charges, but I'm flabbergasted still that nobody pulled him to the side and said, hey, man, you already got one investigation. Maybe you should pick a different title. Just something else. I mean, I'm stunned that that didn't happen.
Oh, anybody with common sense. I mean, let me throw this out at you, Gus. You're talking about that incident happened in 1998, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
18 months later, he's already been told he's not going to get the head coaching job. And the school announces his retirement through a news release. Now, this is a guy who coached the defense of two national championship college football teams. He's been there 32 years, and then all of a sudden, when he retires, they announce it in a statement. It was like in Watergate, there was the 18-minute gap on the Nixon tapes. Well, there's an 18-month gap between what people knew when that 98 report came up and was filed, and when Sandusky was allowed to retire on his own terms with a full pension, tenured status, and access to the Penn State facilities. It was like, just go away from us. Just stay away from the program. You're not with us anymore. The important thing was to save the program, not to save kids.
Wow. I can't even say, just based on what I know, they didn't, as you said, they allowed him access. He was still able to come and get access to the facilities. He had an office. He had a phone. According to reports that I've seen, they were even still investing financially, investing funds into his so-called charity, the Second Mile, and, I mean, not really making too much of an effort to put too much distance between him and the university.
There was a symbiotic relationship. Everybody around Penn State and State College knows everybody else. Most of these people are related to the university because it's the biggest employer in the area. So you draw your paychecks from Penn State, you do what Penn State wants you to do. And that basically is Tampa. It's hard to get more information out of them than it is the CIA. They kept everything internally. They were just their own little world. It's And he worked it that way. And, you know, up until, you mentioned the autobiography, up until he was arrested a month ago, his book is still selling in the campus bookstore, and there's an autographed copy of it in the Paterno Library.
Wow.
And,
wow.
You know, one of the things Penn State is famous for, it's called the Creamery. It's an ice cream shop. They make their own ice cream. They raise their own cows. They make their own ice cream. It's, you know, it's a great school. But one of the flavors on the day he was arrested was called the Sandusky Blitz. Yes. And if you're ready for this, it was a banana-flavored ice cream with chocolate nuts and a cinnamon swirl. Now, explain that to me, Gus.
You are making this up.
I can't. I can't make this up. I can't. It's a, in the research I've done, and you uncover these things, and you look at it, and you say, this cannot have been possible, and yet there it is. It just, it's all there.
Man, the Sandusky Blitz. Folks, look that up.
Yeah.
I think that's worse than the touch. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't think you can order it. They pulled it from the 100 flavors they had there. But it was definitely sold at the and you could buy it online.
What to say, folks? What to say? And there's another connection. I didn't realize until you came on the program. I guess you had already made the connection. I didn't realize there were so many similarities between what happened at Penn State and the Jeffrey Dahmer thing. You got the ice cream connection here. Jeffrey Dahmer working in a chocolate factory.
Right.
I became interested in all of this because of racism. To me, I don't know if irony is the correct term, but many of his victims, a disproportionate number of his victims being black males, and certainly the bulk of them being non-white males, I found it incredible that he's working at a chocolate factory, and then storing the genitals and a mummified head in his locker at the chocolate factory.
Yeah, it just boggles your mind, doesn't it? If I was going to make a suggestion to you, you do a lot of research, do a Google search on the a Pittsburgh Courier. That's a African-American newspaper in Pittsburgh. It's the oldest one in the country. And one of their columnists raised the issue of the Sandusky victims being black, and why is nobody ever mentioning that? Now, the reason I get from law enforcement is, well, we don't identify victims of sexual abuse, and if we said they were black, that would somehow give away their identity, which I find offensive, don't you?
Wow. Why do you find that offensive?
Well, because of if you identify a person's race, that somehow is an identifying factor. These are people. Why would you not say who they were? I mean, you know, at least give more indication what they did. I could be a crotchety old man, but I think that way.
I think you're correct. I would just, you know, want you to explain that logic for our listeners. I think leaving out that information, and I even have had to be conditional about saying about the racial classification of the victims in the Sandusky case, because I don't know. I haven't really seen any reports that have substantiated, yes, these number of the victims were black. I haven't really seen that. So I'm guessing and going off. He said, she said, it's not really clear. I totally agree
exactly.
with you. I think
exactly. Because these kids come from, what's the politically correct term, underprivileged,
disadvantaged youth
households. Right. They live in the projects. They live across the tracks. They come from the poor side of town. To me, I think that the race of the victims gave this guy cover to keep doing what he was doing, and it made it easier for people either turn their heads or not see what they were looking at.
That right there, in my opinion, that totally changes the dynamic of this entire incident. That's what it is. If it's, hey, these were black children, and we don't really have that much regard for black children. If that's, you know, in any way, shape, or form what went down here, that should be reported. That racism, we're looking right at it, and we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to keep that under the curb. We just won't report that the victims were black. And I'd heard many people say, well, I won't say many, but I heard many black people saying they felt that if these victims in the Sandusky case, if they had been white, it would have been announced, and this would have stopped much sooner. Way back with Ray Greekard, the district attorney in 1998, charges would have been filed. This would have played out totally different, and would have been reported totally different if the victims had been white. I could not agree with you more, Mr. Dvorak.
I share that view. Right. I share that view of your listeners.
Wow. Any of the folks, if you all have questions that are listening in, if you want to dial in, ask a question or two, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Just press star 6 if you're on that line and you have a question you want to ask. Folks that are on the TalkShoe line, if you have a question you want to ask, the number to dial is, you know the number. The number, just press star 8 if you have a question if you're on that line. I guess back with Mr. Dom, I'm excited now for the Sandusky book because that's one I've been paying attention to a lot more of late and trying to read information. I'm going to check out that post in the Pittsburgh Courier. Make sure I tell listeners as well. The Pittsburgh Courier, do you know the author's name, the person who wrote that piece?
I can't think of it off the top of my head. I'm not in front of my screen right now. But I think if you do a search on Pittsburgh Courier, Paterno, and Penn State, you'll see it.
Okay. I'll try and find it. If I locate it, I'll put it on my Facebook page, listeners, and I'll put it in the chat room, too, if I can track it down. Any of you all find it, do the same. Share information. With Jeffrey Dahmer, did any of his, like, co-workers at the chocolate factory, did any of them think, hey, there's something wrong with this guy? Did any of them have any suspicions about him?
I think they thought he was a weirdo, that, you know, he was always a loner by himself. He didn't mix in with them. He ate lunch alone. I think he was, just pretty much left alone because, well, he was working the overnight shift anyway, the graveyard, so they just kind of thought he was a little peculiar. There were other people who had concerns, including the people who lived in his apartment building, which, by the way, isn't there anymore. It's been demolished and turned into a park. Neighbors would complain. And Gus, listen to this. I mean, he was maybe the only or one of the two or three white tenants in an apartment building. So if he has problems with they're smelling these foul and officious odors coming from his apartment, and he says, oh, my freezer broke down or my aquarium malfunctioned, nothing was done. And there were tenants there who complained about these things, and were ignored. There was no action ever taken on the complaints that were filed by the other residents of the apartment building.
See, I didn't know that aspect either, that he lived, he was one of the few white people to see. Wow.
And Milwaukee's not unlike most northern cities. There are black populations in these cities, but there is an element of racism in everyone. Pittsburgh is a racist city. Milwaukee is. Boston. I mean, there are elements of racism in every major American city. And it's almost like the two separate worlds exist side by side, but they don't mix very well or very often.
Wow. That is incredible. That is incredible. I saw one of the documentaries. They had, I don't know if he was a custodian or something in charge of building maintenance, but he was talking about the odors, and he went to try to get this problem resolved. And I'm again thinking, if this had been a black tenant, he would have been thrown out. There would have been much much quicker action and probably more punitive where he would have been discovered if this had been a black person. I didn't know that until I started researching. I want to get one of the callers, but I'm trying to multitask. I'm looking on Pittsburgh Courier's website, and their front page story, the first thing that I saw when I went to the webpage, the Jerry Sandusky Penn State situation, they likened it to what's happening with the Red Sox manager, who was also recently accused for molesting young black children. Front page on the Pittsburgh Courier. Pattern of behavior.
That's a good paper. That's a good paper. They tell it like it is. They always have.
I'm going to read that Pittsburgh Courier. Check that out, folks. It's newpittsburghcourieronline.com. That's the address, new PittsburghCourierOnline.com, and that's the first article on the page when you get to it, comparison of what Jerry Sandusky did at Penn State. It's Penn State scandal similar to Boston Red Sox clubhouse manager molestation of black boys. First page on the first article on the page. Mr. Scotty Reed, he's with the Black Talk Radio Network. Did you have a question for our guest, Mr. Dvorchak?
You are unmuted.
Dvorchak.
Yes, I do. Greetings, Gus. Robert, if I may ask, I read a report to where police officers actually found a naked young man possibly bleeding from his rectal area, and that they took him back to Jeffrey Dahmer, and he somehow talked them out of, you know, an investigation and actually delivered this young man to his death. Did you do any research that uncovered the thinking of or the reasoning of these officers? And after Jeffrey Dahmer was discovered to be doing the things that he was doing, did they face any kind of disciplinary action?
Good question. Good question. Your analysis is correct. That did happen. In fact, it was a 13-year-old Laotian boy, and if you have a second, I'll tell you the story that he had brought this kid. He'd taken this kid into his confidence and groomed him, and he had him upstairs, and he had him drugged. Now, Jeffrey runs out of beer. So he goes down to the corner and buys 2 6-packs, and when he gets back to his apartment building, the boy had gotten awake and ran downstairs into the street naked, running and screaming for help. Now, unfortunately, he's screaming for help in Laotian. Nobody understands him. Police come by, and Dahmer says, "Oh, that's my boyfriend. And we were having an argument, and it spilled out into the street. I'll take him upstairs and calm him down." Well, the officers actually went upstairs with him, and, you know, not knowing that the boy was really 13 and thought he was older. And Jeffrey, the evil genius that he is, shows them Polaroid pictures he had taken of the boy in his underwear. And he had done that, and he said, "Look, see, this is what we were doing. We were engaged in this, and the fight broke out. But you leave us alone, and I'll handle everything." And the police are just like, can't wait to wipe their hands of this and get out of this situation. So they turn him back over to Dahmer, while this evil, whatever he is, has human remains in the apartment building. And he was able to convince the cops that he would control this situation, and they didn't need to worry about anything, and they could leave. Now, the police officers involved were brought up and charged with utter and complete negligence and were fired, and they were out of a job for maybe like 5 years before the police union was able to get them reinstated. So they went back to being police officers. Chew on that for a while.
Wow. Mr. Reed, I don't see. I was opening your line back up. If you had a question, if you wanted to follow up, make sure that was clear. That is incredible.
It happened, Mr. Reed.
Wow. I mean, I almost feel ignorant for asking. These officers that were reinstated, do you know if they were white or not?
Yes, I do, and they were, yes. Which, you got an Asian kid, a Laotian kid. They're different from, the white cops. They can't relate. They don't do things that way. If it was a... Let me tell you this, and you both know this. If that was a white kid, Dahmer would have never made it past the apartment door again.
Oh, Mr. Reed, I see him. Your line should be open, Mr. Reed. Mr. Reed, did that answer your question? Your line should be open, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I didn't really have another question, but I have a comment, you know, from listening to the program you did last night, Gus. And the first thing that came to my mind is your guest from last night said, you know, that when white people, and Jeffrey Dahmer was a white person, interact with police, that, you know, they expect white supremacy to work for them. And so I think, you know, that in this case, with this young man being non-white, Jeffrey being white, and Robert just said the cops were white, that white supremacy delivered this young man into their hands. And that's all I have to say. Great program.
Wow, thank you. That is, I am stunned. Like I said, I had no interest in this at all, Mr. Dvorak, none. Like, I never researched this. I didn't watch it. I didn't read news clippings at all. Just racist. In fact, a person who helped me a lot to understand racism, he said, if you want the epitome of how racism functions, if you could stick it on one person, he said, I would pick Jeffrey Dahmer. And my mouth fell on the ground. I was like, are you serious? And he said, yes, I would pick Jeffrey Dahmer. If you want one person that I think is the epitome, everything about it, able to evade enforcement officers because, hey, he's a white person. we just have a different standard for how we deal with and treat white people as opposed to black people especially. And the victims, you said, having that radar, the radar of a predator. And it seems, hey, people to pick out as victims, non-white people, especially black males, wow. And just some of the information that you shared, these officers being reinstated, I cannot imagine that happening. If the victim in this case had been a white child, male or female, I can't even imagine white people coming to their aid to say, hey, these guys have gotten a tough break. I can't even imagine that. Like, that, man.
And conversely, what if one of the officers or both of them were African American? Would they have done a more thorough search through this guy's house and looked it over better? But hey Gus, it's getting a little late for me. I'm gonna have to bug out pretty soon.
Okay, I want to make sure. Well, I guess I'll double check if any of the listeners, if you all have questions or comments you want to get in, get your hand up quick if you have a question or comment while I'm checking. I just want to ask your opinion. Do you feel like there was any remorse? Do you feel like Mr. Dahmer, he was ever sorry for what he had done?
I don't think he's capable of showing remorse. The sociopathic personality is as bizarre as this is going to sound. I don't think in his mind he was thinking he was doing anything wrong. He was driven by his impulses. I don't think he ever felt any remorse or a guilt for it, but I do think that he was unable to live with the reality of his situation, which is why he wanted to get killed, to kill himself. He was suicide by beating in prison. That's what it was. But he had gotten to the point where he knew that there was nothing he could do to control the urges inside him, and he was just tired of living with it. He was so exhausted in trying to project an image that he was unable to continue, which might have led to why he got caught after all those years, 17 years.
Wow. The person who called in, 404-404, did you have a quick question you wanted to ask Mr. Dvorak?
Yes, I do. Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other listeners. What I wanted to ask the guest is, I vaguely recall reading somewhere about his history in the military that he also exhibited psychotic tendencies in the military, and he was discharged. Did you cover that by chance?
The military is like any other organization. If you got a misfit, somebody that doesn't fit in with the program and never will, you deal with it by getting rid of it. So they just discharged him without ever having to put up with it. Now, you know, they're not required to share medical information. He didn't commit any crimes in the military, but his behavior warranted the attention of his superiors, and they deal with it by getting rid of the problem, so they let him go.
Okay. You said he was beaten up in prison. His death came by way of suicide by inmates, where he deliberately set himself up to be killed by the inmates in the facility. Is that what?
Yes. He was in solitary confinement for a year because if he was in general population, his life would have been over in a matter of hours, which is exactly what happened, because he has to be put in general population. And another inmate bludgeoned him to death with a barbell pipe.
Was this person a black person, the person that killed him?
The person who killed him was white.
Was a white person?
Right, who thought he was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. And since Jeffrey thought he was possessed by the devil, yeah, there was a biblical connotation to that.
So how long altogether did he spend in confinement before he was killed?
A year. He lasted a year in isolation. And if you can put
From his sentencing, from the time he was sentenced to prison to his death, was only 1 year?
Yes. That was after the trial and everything, when he got sent away to prison. But can you imagine, if you live for 12 months in a cell by yourself and all you can do is think about what horrible things you've done, it would be hard to live with yourself, don't you think?
Not really. I could think that he probably might have a longing or a lust for some of the cannibalism that he partake in. And being locked away, and he probably might have images of the, if you believe in ghosts and people riding you, as people would say in old days, the devil riding your back. Maybe they might have shown up in his cell and drove him out from there, and he couldn't stay in there anymore. They keep appearing in his dreams or keep showing up in his cell with him, and he had to get out from being by himself.
It's a good point. I just don't know if I can answer that.
Okay, well, you've been very helpful, and thanks for answering my question.
Well, thanks for calling.
I don't see any other. Yes, sir. I don't see any other hands, so thank you for sharing.
Because you have good listeners. They ask good questions. My compliments to you and your audience.
They they run the show. I'm just hanging out. Thank you so much.
Well, they always do. So they're like readers run the show with me. So.
I will be looking out. You said March. The new book should be coming out in March. Is that correct?
Right, by HarperCollins out of New York.
Okay. I will be looking out. I will definitely be in touch. We would love to have you back on the program to go into more detail about your new work and sexual predators, if you'd be down to come back and speak with us again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Gus.
Absolutely. Take good care, sir.
You bet. Have a good night.
You too.
All right.
Good evening. The cows, our guest, Mr. Robert J. Dvorak. My apologies. He does have, there's another white person. You all should look online. There's another white person who has the exact same name, same initial and everything. He looks just like our guest for the evening. At any rate, I'll correct the description once we're all done. I do think he had great information, and in fact, I'm going to play the sound clip where Neely Fuller Jr. gives his view on Jeffrey Dahmer. This is a slightly longer sound clip, but I think it will make great sense, particularly given what we just heard about Mr. Dahmer from Robert J. Dvorak. This is Neely Fuller Jr. This conversation took place in the summer of 2010, where Mr. Fuller, I'll just step back and play the clip. What I'll do, we'll do a quick commercial break, and then I'll play the sound clip. So commercial and then Neely Fuller, and once I'm done, then I'll check the phone lines. I'm very eager if folks have thoughts, comments that they would like to share. Any of the information that has been shared about Jeffrey Dahmer, be looking forward to hearing that. We'll be right back, other side of the commercial, context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at TRIMultimedia.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. This is Justice with the Cows Radio program. If you want to learn about, understand, and counter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed, packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, for more information on racism, white supremacy, and to invest in my counter-racist efforts, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
Yo, this is Wade, one half of the Black Twins. I want y'all to check something out. Our latest project, Double Consciousness, the Mixed Message. This will be dropping October 2nd, 2011, featuring various audio from Umar Abdullah Johnson and Dr. Ken Baum, just to name a few. You can download this at www.gacmusicroom.bandcamp.com and at stlouismixtapes.com. That's stlmixtapes.com. Replace white supremacy with justice now.
This mixtape is only for victims of racism and white supremacy.
Place. For generalities, I generally say that if you want the ultimate expression of white supremacy and the white supremacist mentality, and you want to put it in the form of one person that I would name, and that's something I very seldom do, it would be Jeffrey Dahmer. He's the ultimate expression of white supremacy. Everything that he was doing, working in a chocolate factory, the whole nine yards, and storing black male bodies in canisters of lye and alcohol and whatnot, and got them in the refrigerator, and cannibalism and all of that, and calm, very methodical. Even when questioned by the law enforcement officers, very calm. Hannibal Lecter, you know. The ultimate.
What
Aryan looking.
Wasn't he with young boys too?
Yeah. he was, I mean, I forgot how many bodies. Is, you know, what, you know, something like 20 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can probably look it up on the computer. Jeffrey Dahmer, mm-hmm. You know. He didn't even try to protect him once he went to prison. He was so embarrassing to everybody, I guess. I mean, you know, everybody who really thinks like he does. They warned him out of the way. But the black guy killed him in prison.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. See, and I think he was set up to be dead because, you know, he was considered a monster. So he's just as calm as he can be. You know, very methodical, very meticulous, went to work on time, excellent worker, working in a chocolate factory. Looking at chocolate being churned all day. And out there trying to churn chocolate at night. The ultimate expression. Roman Empire. Black death associated. Black. Anti-sex with non-white people associated ultimately with death as being the ultimate. Gather them up, befriend them to the extent that you're saying that, hey, I'm going to take you, a black male, and make you ultimately effeminate, and then kill you.
Mm.
First chance I get.
And he ate them too, didn't he? Wasn't that his thing?
Yes, and eat the bodies, eat the body parts. Got the body parts in wrappers in the refrigerator.
Mm.
And got other body parts, I mean, he didn't know what to do with, I mean, because he got so many. And got them in big drums full of acid and whatnot. Keep them right there, not somewhere way out in the woods somewhere. Keep them right there in our apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And then go out and gather up some more, I mean, you know, bringing them in one at a time.
Wow.
He probably, you know, you can probably look his name up on the computer and get the whole story. I mean, from A to Z. They've written several books on it and whatnot. I had newspapers and on it and all like that. But that's my statement, that he's the ultimate expression of that type of mentality. Not Adolf Hitler, Jeffrey Dahmer.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Because this is what ultimately this white supremacy at its greatest is that, particularly aiming at the black male. Effeminize the black male and then take him and kill him after that. I mean, not enough just to make him into a thing, but then methodically and with an expression of affection, kill him. Because the black males he was picking up were very trusting of him. Hey, here's a nice white guy. I mean, you know, he's buying me drinks and whatnot, and friendly, and, you know, he ain't calling me nigger and wanting to drag me, by, you know, and burn crosses on my lawn and whatnot. No, he wants to take me to his house. Oh, he's okay. Oh, yeah. Got to be some reason why a person would even think like that.
Mm.
But the evidence shows that such people do exist.
Wow. Never even heard anybody mention Jeffrey Dahmer as, you know, a racist or a racist suspect or anything.
Well, he would be a racist suspect just by being white, according to the code.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to be a racist, so he probably is one. That's code, according to what I've written.
Yes, sir.
And I stick with that. If a white person in the system of white supremacy is able to be a racist, he or she probably is one, period. That doesn't change until the end of white supremacy.
Mm.
That's the criteria for that. So that's a given.
Wow.
Based on what? Logic. Not panic, not irrationality, or whatever that means. Not, you know, just being super judgmental up front. No, that's logical. It's logical to believe that, because it's dangerous not to. I'm quite sure those fellows sitting around Jeffrey Dahmer probably thought, you know, hey, this guy can't be a racist. You know, he likes to hang out with black guys, you know,
mm-hmm.
all the time, you know. Plenty of white guys around here, I mean, you know, usually, you know, he stands out. He don't even care what white guys think. You know? He sits over here and drinks with the black guys. He's okay.
Wow. I didn't know that he worked in a chocolate factory. I'd heard the story.
Worked in a chocolate factory, standing right there, churning chocolate all day long. And a whole Sigmund Freud would have a field day with that one.
And Dr. Welsen, that's right. What she had to say, too.
Well, she already has.
Wow.
It didn't mystify her at all.
Wow. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And his co-workers said, hey, you know, easy going, easy get along, no problem, give nobody no problem at all, always on time, good worker, always did his job very efficiently. Systematic mass killer. And a cannibal. A white cannibal.
Hmm.
You know, traditionally they always say black people were cannibals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nobody would suspect him. No suspicion at all from the
and this is why he got away with it so long. Got away with it. I mean, you know, I mean, they were looking all around. I mean, you know, hiding in plain sight. Law enforcement officers talking to him. And he's saying, yeah, you know, strange things happen, you know. Got to be alert these days.
Wow.
Nary, never was on the suspicion list. Like one so-called Asian guy, you know, non-white, ran out in the street, flagged down a law enforcement car. Jeffrey Dahmer just sauntered right out behind him and said, oh, he's a little delusional, whatnot, you know. I'm paying attention to him. He's a nice guy, you know. I'll look out for him. Mm-hmm. He's running from Jeffrey Dahmer. Managed to escape from him. And ran out in the street and flagged down a car. And the law enforcement officers helped Jeffrey Dahmer take him back in the house.
Wow.
Cool. I mean, you know, like ice under fire, you know. Didn't show the least bit of nervousness. He wound up dead, too. The guy, same guy. That's how they finally caught Jeffrey Dahmer. But not because of that. But that put, you know, that made him suspicious because he was reported missing and whatnot. I think that's how it went down. But the main thing was people started, you know, getting these odors in the place where he lived. These strange odors. Where are these odors coming from? All those bodies that he's carving up.
Mm. Wow. That is crazy. That is crazy.
So I just use him. Of course, there are other people who have done things similar and all like that, but I use Jeffrey Dahmer because all, with the exception of, I think the first person they had him on record was a person who was white. But that must have been OJT type thing.
Mm-hmm.
As on the job training. You know, a white sacrifice. And then all the rest of them was not white.
Hmm. Was it mostly black males or?
Mostly black males.
Hmm.
As far as they know, the last one was the Laotian, or you know, a non-white male from Laos. I think he's maybe about 17 years old, 18, something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, so he's an interesting study, but I say that he's the ultimate expression, because see, that's basically what the white supremacists do. With that racism, when you take it to its nth degree, it's destructive and goes right into, and the most destructive acts are something that's sexual or anti-sexual. That's why I put in my book long before there was a Jeffrey Dahmer.
Hmm.
It has to do with, hey, this is why, you know, in back in the old days, it wasn't enough just to lynch a black guy. No, hey, that ain't, you know, hey, that's too much, like, you know, feel like you lynched, might have lynched a man. You don't want to do that. I mean, you know, take his sex organs out, you know. Got to do that. Yeah, just don't hang a nigga, you know. Cut all his sex organs up.
Hmm. Hmm.
Not enough to kill him. That's too much like killing a man. I mean, you know, hey, you don't want to leave, you know. No, don't even want to think in that direction, that this creature is a man. That's competition. So make him a thing. Some type of creature. But we can't stand that idea of a black male being a man, physically and mentally, those two together? No. Boy, maybe. girl, thing, but man, no. That's why the code is all about aiming for the production, universal man, universal woman. That's in the textbook. That's the ultimate goal with all of the characteristics. And it'll, you know, in the next book, I just try to list a whole bunch of the characteristics. I mean, first of all, a person that believes in revelation of truth. Got to start with that one. And definitely be against racism and against any kind of injustice. I mean, these have got to be the characteristics of universal man and universal woman that will fit the character of the universe itself. When it is not tampered with in an incorrect manner.
Context of white supremacy. We are back live. Again, that sound clip, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., author of the United Independent Compensatory Code System Concept, as well as the accompanying word guide. If you need a copy of the word guide or the code book, you can put in this address, tiny.cc/Fuller, and put Fuller in all caps. So tiny.cc/Fuller, and Fuller is in all caps. You can print out the order form, get your copy of the word guide, code book. You get a discount if you get them both at the same time. But, yeah, that was last summer, and I have to give thanks to Black Megatroid. He's quoted in Pam and the others who authored Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, the White Racist Code of Conduct. But I was speaking with him just a few days back, and I guess I said something about this on the program at some point. I was just saying Mr. Fuller said Jeffrey Dahmer would be the representation of white supremacy and blah, blah, blah. And he remembered that. And he was like, yeah, why don't you do that program on Dahmer? And I was like, yeah, I was supposed to do that. We were supposed to do that last year. And as I said at the very beginning, I've been contacting our guest, Mr. Dvorak. It's been about 18 months since we've been emailing and suggesting dates, and I keep picking dates. And he said, nah, that's not going to work. And this went back and forth and back and forth. And I had just forgotten about it. And Black Megatroid reminded me. I sent him another message. And he messaged back, and I just want to make sure I get this in as well. He messaged back on Sunday. He said, how about Tuesday, today, December 13th? This was not one of the original dates that I had suggested, but just because I felt it was important to get the information out, I said, fine, if that date will work for you, let's do it. So it was very short notice, but I felt like, you know, it was important, hopefully the information constructive. More than anything, I hope that this further solidifies the connection between so-called homosexual activity, anti-sex, and white supremacy. They are hand in hand. You should think of Jeffrey Dahmer. Think of Jeffrey Dahmer. And in fact, I'm going to start mentioning Jeffrey Dahmer anytime a white person makes some sort of comment that is less than saying sex between black people and non-white people is totally incorrect. I'm going to mention Jeffrey Dahmer. Say, hey, he had sex with a lot of black people. I certainly wouldn't say he was a friend to black people. I certainly wouldn't say that anything about what he was doing was working against racism, right? I'm going to just reference him from now on, but I hope that that is firmly in people's mind. And another example of how slick white people can be with words. I mean, he is carving up corpses by the dozen in his room. Black males mostly, carving them up by the dozen, and is able to use words to, nope, Mr. Officer, nothing wrong at all. This is my lover. We're doing great. Just a little lover's quarrel. And everything is, I mean, woo, keep that in comparison to, you know, any example that you need. Sean Bell, Oscar Grant, Amadou Diallo, any example that you need. Just, you know, if you ever lose sight of what it means to be in a system of white supremacy. And also, I didn't know that information about the officers who escorted one of the victims back to Jeffrey Dahmer, that white people came to their aid to get them their job back. Just another illustration of your life means nothing if you are non-white as long as white supremacy exists. I'll quote Pulp Fiction again, nobody will be missed. I will go to the phone lines and give folks an opportunity if there's anything you all want to share about the broadcast, Jeffrey Dahmer. I did not know that our guest, Mr. Dvorak, I didn't know that he was also working on a book about what's going on at Penn State. I will definitely have that in mind to get him back on the program in March to get more information. The article that he was talking about on the Pittsburgh Courier, that article, it is by Earl Ofori Hutchinson. Black male, and the article, excuse me, wrong article, there were several. Mr. Hutchinson, he also wrote a report on this. The article that he was talking about on the Pittsburgh Courier, Penn State, how many victims were black, and it was written by Danny J. Bakewell. Danny J. Bakewell, the article, Penn State, how many victims were black. It's on the Pittsburgh Courier. You can check out the post. It was published on November 23rd, Wednesday, November 23rd, on the Pittsburgh Courier. You can get it online, newpittsburghcourieronline.com. And as I said, the post for today about the similarities between the sexual molestation, the Red Sox manager, also an older white man, pedophile taking advantage of young black children. This is standard operating procedure. White people have been doing this forever. Forever. We should just be stockpiling this information. And again, I will remind folks, Dr. Frances Kress Welsing, her saying, this is why we cannot be careless with sex. Doing so, it is the offspring who will suffer, because there are plenty of racist pedophiles on the loose who are looking for young black children to victimize. We cannot be reckless with sex under conditions of war. Also, before I hit the phone lines, I want to make sure that I get in. If you notice, I didn't use the term white supremacy. I actually had a snicker about this. I think Scotty Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network, he was the first person to use the term white supremacy today. I strategically was not using that term because I really just wanted to get the information about Dahmer. I really just wanted to get as much of that as I could from this white person, and then have Mr. Fuller come in and bang, connect all the dots to racism. But he brought a lot of it out. The white person, he was revealing some truth about the racism that was there. And I think he even said that the racism in the Dahmer case, it has to be there. Both him being a white person and being able to benefit from that in a system of racism, white supremacy, and selecting victims that were non-white. It's racism all the way through, consciously, unconsciously. I would suspect consciously, but yeah, and again, as I said to him, this is something that I wouldn't really have studied at all if Mr. Fuller had not made those statements to me when I spoke with him last year about investigating what happened with Jeffrey Dahmer and him carving up and eating black males. But yeah, necrophilia. We've said that many times during the course of the cows. There you go. The embodiment of that, Jeffrey Dahmer, and I think many white people participated in that to varying degrees. Their gross consumption of chocolate and brownies and all of that. Necrophilia, dark liquids, coffee, Coca-Cola. Doctor, Mr. Fuller said that Dr. Welsing did a whole lecture on Jeffrey Dahmer and white supremacy. I've never heard that. If anybody has heard it, please let me know. If you have a copy, I would love to check it out, but I've never heard her break down Jeffrey Dahmer according to her theory of white genetic annihilation. I'm thinking I might have to borrow her again, see if we can get her to come on the program and break that down, because I've never heard her go into detail about that. At any rate, but yeah, just again to emphasize, I was purposely not using the term white supremacy. I really wasn't even going to talk about racism too much. If you heard, I was saying cows and not context of white supremacy, just because I wanted that information. And I think for me, I hope that's another example of how you can be very strategic about what you know. You don't need to prove to every white person what you know about racism, white supremacy. Go into conversations with an objective, an agenda. What is it that I'm trying to do? What is my purpose for being in contact and communication with this white person? And really, you can use that anytime. What is my purpose for exerting my time and energy. What am I trying to get? And I just wanted the information about Dahmer. I hope that it was constructive for folks. I will check the phone lines, 404, you one of the folks that called in, excuse me, any of the folks that dialed in, if you're on TalkShoe and you have questions or comments, star 8, I can get your line open. Any of the folks that are on the free HD line, and that number, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. If you're on that line, press star 6. If you have a question, if you're on the TalkShoe line, it's star 8. Anybody that has questions or comments, 404, your line should be open, and I'll look out for other folks.
Okay. Thanks, Gus. I was going to ask you, because he said that the person that killed Dahmer was a white male, and someone in the chat room, they wrote that it was a black male, because I do recall, my memory serves me correct, I believe they said it was a black person that did the killing. So were you able to verify whether or not it was a white or a black person that actually killed Dahmer?
The information that I saw, it was a black male, the mm-hmm. person who thought he was the re-embodiment of Christ. Actually, they have a lot of documentaries. If you all want to check, you can go on YouTube. They have quite a few where you can hear, you know, Dahmer explaining a lot of this himself and his dad, but they showed video footage, and it was a black male that I saw. I could be incorrect, but I the reports I saw, it was a black male, and I saw several that said it was a black male.
Okay, because I was almost positive that it was a black male that killed him, because after the amount of bodies that he killed, black bodies, I'm quite sure it was. It had to be somebody black that would eventually seek revenge on him and take him out. But I'll go online and I'll do some research. But it's most interesting, this Dahmer character, and as you said, you know, you'll use the Dahmer reference because it needs to be used, because these people, they like using this nonsense and always talk about cannibalism and put it on every person of color, especially black people and the native, the so-called Native Americans here. And these people, white people, have been doing this stuff for years. They've been cannibalizing each other, and then they started on other people.
Absolutely. Just doing my research, there's another white person that they referenced because they were trying to get into the mind of a cannibal and a necrophiliac, and they went and asked this other white person, and he had a ton of tattoos, total Dr. Welsing moment. He had tattoos all over his body, and he was talking about, yeah, and you eat the body, and it gives you this feeling and that feeling, and it was a white person. And I said, now, I can't think of a single non-white person that I could name. Like, if you said, Gus, I will give you $5 million right now if you can name a black cannibal in the last 50 years, I would be out of luck. I could not name one. I would be grasping. I'd have to beg a white, can you help me? Can you name somebody? I couldn't even make up somebody. I could give you now several white names of white cannibals, and they even make movies about it and everything. I just,
yep.
It's just white people clowning hard, and that's just the question I'm going to ask from now on. If anybody ever does bring that up in my presence again, saying that black people are cannibals, and that's our history, can you name a black cannibal, someone in the last 50 years, you could even do the last 100 years, can you name a black person who has participated in so-called cannibalism? And just wait and see if they can give you a name. And then after that, you can ask them, can you name a white person? And I'm quite certain they're going to be able to give you some white names.
You are right, because they have Dracula, they have Vlad the Impaler, they have a whole trove in their history from Jack the Ripper. They have them with all of these colorful names that have been going around flashing and doing things to people. But as you said, we can't go back in our ancient history and come up with one black person that did these things that these people are doing. And then he said it was black law enforcement that took this young man and turned him back over to Dahmer, or were they white when this boy ran out into the street?
Man, you have to You'll have to forgive me for a moment. There are talking owls and a talking moose. White people clown very, very hard. All I can say, I'm sitting, there are about 20 Christmas trees surrounding me, and okay, they stopped talking. Sorry about that. All right. The officer, the enforcement officers who escorted the victim back to Jeffrey Dahmer, he said that they were white. Okay. I knew that bit before. I did not know until he came on the program today that those officers were fired, but white people rallied to their defense and got them their jobs back. I did not know that information until today.
That's typical. That is very typical of white people, because you never find a black man. It could be my father. My father could be whooping my behind in the middle of the street, and I could have ran over there and flagged the officer down when he could say, well, that's my job. They would never have turned me back over to him. They would have put me in the back of the car, and they would have taken me to the station, and he would have had to come down with some kind of ID and produce something to show that I belong to him, or we're the same color. But here it is with this Asian child and this white male, and they feel comfortable that this child belonged with this white man to turn him back over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just imagine the inquiry. I hope people remember Terry Kelleher, just so, you know, you'll have an idea of the seriousness of all this. Terry Kelleher, admitted racist, and he's homosexual, admitted racist, admitted so-called homosexual. He adopted a black male child from the womb. He was on the program in January of this year. Just, you know, have that in mind while we discuss Jeffrey Dahmer. Just if you all can imagine a black male with a white child, like a black male, let's say he's 30, with a white child, same age, let's say 14, and this white child is running out middle of the night in distress, no shirt on, and imagine some white enforcement officer saying, oh, you know, let's take you back up to Jamal, everything should be all right, just, you know, this was just a lover's quarrel, that's all, good night, you know, have a good evening, just imagine that for a moment.
It's not going to happen. My imagination can't stretch that wide, because I know it's not going to happen. Jamal's going to get a beat down. His face is going to be in the dirt. He's going to have guns pulled on him. And he'll be back out of a squad car. It wouldn't happen. And the white child is the most precious thing in this country, the white child and the white woman. So it wouldn't happen. Remember what your guest Mark writing, that you're supposed to get him back on the show, what he said he went through with his own foster child.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. I did email him about being back on the program. I will get his number again and give him a call, see if we can nab him back on the program. But I did follow up on that as well.
Because it doesn't happen out in this society. A white person could have any rainbow of colors of children, and it would not be a problem. They could say, yes, that's mine. Produce no ID. They wouldn't ask, can I see some ID? Could I see something to show that this child belongs to you? It wouldn't happen. But if you're black and the person is black, you have to produce all kind of ID, the blood type, mother's maiden name, everything before the child is going to be turned back over to you.
Timothy McVeigh, I'm reminded, according to reports that I've seen, another terrorist, when he went out to blow up the building in Oklahoma, he was getting supplies and what have you, and they did not ask him for identification. He went to the store to purchase these explosive materials, and he said, oh, I left my ID in the car, and the car, oh, don't worry about it, we don't, you know, you don't need to do all that, we got you. Just, you know... If you are a white person, you can be a serial killer, terrorist, whatever. Just you being white, the system of white supremacy will work for you. It is much easier. Anything you want to do as a white person, you want to eat 12 black people, you want to blow up a federal building, whatever. It's going to be way easier for you to do it just because you are white.
I could not believe it. He said that it is called Sandusky Blitz.
Talk about it, man.
Banana nuts, chocolate.
I'm going to Google that as soon as the program ends. Sandusky, but I didn't even have to write it down. I knew I was going to remember that. Sandusky Blitz.
You can't make this up, as the man said. You cannot make this up. The name of his book and the name of the ice cream that they sell.
Man, and it's so many connect. I'm so glad that he brought that up. Like I said, this was short notice that he's doing the book on what's going down at Penn State as well. And that's going to be one that I'm definitely going to follow up on. Remind me if I miss out on that to get him back on the program in March to get more information. Because he seemed pretty informed about what was happening at Penn State too with the victim. And I'm going to ask him that about how he got information about the victims being black, because I haven't seen anything. I haven't seen any reports to substantiate that. How did they get that information? I haven't seen that at all. I am going to follow up with him after the program just to see where he got that information from.
Is he from the Pittsburgh area, the guest that you had on?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, because he mentioned a lot. So maybe he knows, he would have more information as a white person up in that area.
One thing I did want to make sure that I get in, a lot of people, they're spectating, I guess. If you all have questions or comments, if you're on the talk show line, star 8. If you're on the free HD line, it's star 6. I definitely wanted to make sure that I got in. I would encourage you all to do some research on what happened with Jeffrey Dahmer. Like I said, they have a ton of documentaries. You can watch them on YouTube. One of them is Confessions of a Serial Killer, where they talk with his mom, they talk with his dad. They have another one. He was on Larry King Live, his dad and his stepmom. They have another one where they have at least two others where they go to prison while he was still alive, and they talk to him and get him to, you know, give some of the grisly details. It is a stat. That's not even the correct word. Let me give the correct term. It is extraordinarily offensive, and it really illustrates the incorrectness of this system. I was talking to Justice, and she said that she doesn't call white people victims for anything. Like, even if, you know, their house burns down, I still don't call them a victim. And we were talking about that. And I was watching this documentary. I don't remember the one. If I remember the exact title, I'll tell you all. But it really doesn't matter. You can watch several of them. They called Jeffrey Dahmer's mom a victim. They called Jeffrey Dahmer a tragic. They didn't say tragic hero.
Yep.
They said he's a tragic figure. I mean, I'm just sitting here looking at this like they are about to say Jeffrey Dahmer is a victim. They had a white person. He was, I guess, one of his schoolmates or when he was in high school. And he did a whole comic book on Jeffrey Dahmer and how, he got beaten up when he was in high school and he just had a tough time. And it's so sad how this one, man, I was like, man, this is absurd. Like, I mean, just the unbelievableness of it all. I mean, it's astounding. This guy has killed 17 people. He ate them, stored the bodies, raped them. I mean, the worst of the worst. And we are talking as though he's a victim. And not only that, they really humanized him. And when I say humanized, what I mean, I cannot imagine if Jeffrey Dahmer had been a black person, or non-white person, period, but especially a black person, them bringing his parents on and being kind and, you know, just tell us your story. We're not trying to beat up on you. We're not trying to blame you. We're not trying to make it seem like it's your fault. Just, you know, what happened? Can you give us more information? Can you think of anything that's, I mean, it is astounding to see how white people treat one of the most vile criminals, I would say, easily in the last 30 years. It is astounding. And if you just want a comparison, look at the way they treated Michael Vick.
Yep.
He did not kill any people. He didn't eat the dogs. He didn't cut off anything from the dogs and save it, put it in the refrigerator, take it to his locker on campus, anything like that. He should have been killed. They talked about him like he was a savage. They talked about him like he was a cannibal. They didn't do that to Jeffrey Dahmer at all. They didn't treat his parents with that sort of disregard and I'll just leave it there. It's glaring. The person that is on the talk show line called in from Texas. I'll open your line 404. If you have any thoughts on that, feel free. Or the person that's in Texas.
It's the same thing. Like
hello, everybody. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that that was a comedian a few years ago who did a bit, a black comedian, he did a bit on the D.C. sniper. He said, you know, when we thought he was black, we heard a lot about him. And when they found out that he was black, they downgraded it to a nigga in a Buick and took the case off the air. So the D.C. Mm-hmm. sniper was a big one. In the beginning of it, they thought it was a white guy going around sniping folks, and it was 24-hour news. But when it was discovered that, you know, John Muhammad was a black man, then it goes, you know, the sensationalism stops. So they love to glorify their mass murders.
True.
And they make, I've seen them make movies from everybody from Gacy to Dahmer to name them. Every major serial killer they had some kind of network television movie about him. I just wanted to contribute that.
You're correct about it, because I remember when it happened because I myself was thinking it was a white man. They said he was such a sharp shooter. He hit in his target all points and everything else. And I was saying, you know, it has to be a white man, a hunter or something. And the minute they found out it was a black man who was going wrong, that was just such a genius, and he was able to craft this car and set it up in such a way and was doing this killing. It was just, he just faded right off the news. As you said, the sheriff from Montgomery County, they made him into a big star. He was on all the talk shows, and, you know, cowbells for him, too, because he's married to a white woman, the black male. And he was on all these shows and made a hero out of him. And Muhammad and Malvo, they just kind of faded into the woodwork. His wife, John Muhammad, his wife wrote a book detailing her life with him. And she could barely get on the air. They didn't want to feature her in any news article, except if they want to talk about the negative part of the relationship, and they didn't want to say anything else positive about the man. But as Gus put it out, when it comes to people like Charles Manson and Helter Skelter and all of these movies that they have out here about these white killer Ted Bundy, and you could go through it. They have a certain time of the year, like Halloween, they do a run of all these killers that they had, all these white killers in American history, and they glorify them, write books over and over about it, because the guest is about to write another book on all these serial killers, and I bet you they're all going to be white.
Yep. I wish, like I said, I want to get him back on the program, but if we had more time, I would have asked. His parents said that he had a huge following. I'm talking about Jeffrey Dahmer. He had a huge following. They said he used to get all kinds of mail from people who said that they loved him and felt bad for him and that he had caught that. Now, imagine if all the victims had been white. I'll just leave it there.
Remember the Menendez brother that killed their parents? One of them got married in prison. White women was chasing them, writing them all kinds of love letters and marry them. So these people, they have a sickness, they have a fascination. When it comes to these killers, I'm sure if Charles Manson could get him hooked up in prison with a wife, I'm sure they would hook him up, but he's been languishing out there. But they draw a very sympathetic figure when it comes to these people that go through their history with a fine-tooth comb. Oh, he had issues. His mother didn't love him enough. His parents got divorced at an early age. So he has this, you know, all
that's me. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Hello.
Greetings, Miss Sinelli.
Hey, God.
How are you doing?
I'm doing really good.
Are you on speakerphone? Somebody on speakerphone?
No. Sorry, God. Hi.
Okay, I think it's. Oh, are you listening to the program on your computer?
I am listening to the program. I'm trying to tell my partner to mute it. He's not on.
Sorry, gang. I was trying to add in another caller, Ms. Zanelle, a longtime listener. She has great views on white supremacy. She was requesting, she wanted to say, add her 2 cents to the dialogue, so I was trying to add her. My bad for the poor transition.
That's great.
I just wanted to add, it was already said before anyway, that the guest this evening, he was definitely practicing racism because I think he definitely consciously lied and said that it was a white person who killed Jeffrey Dahmer, knowing full well that it was a black man called, sorry, hold on, what was his name? Christopher Scarver, thank you for that. So it was a black man called Christopher Scarver who actually killed Jeffrey Dahmer. And I think for all the research that he's done, he would have definitely known that, but for some reason he didn't reveal that information. So I don't know why he did that. Typical racist, I guess. So I just thought I'd throw that in. It was already added in. My partner already typed it into the chat room, but we didn't know if it was going to be picked up in time. So just thought I'd call them.
Do you think that was... Do you think it could have been some motivation that he had a problem acknowledging or being truthful that it was a black person who actually killed him and that this was a black person who referenced himself as Christ?
I think so. I think it might also have been him attempting to give credit to white people just to show, like, well, it's white people who dealt with Jeffrey Dahmer as opposed to black people, because white people, racist suspects, always have a problem when black people clearly avenge what white people have done when it's obviously racially motivated. So I think that's his own issues that he's got with that. That's why he concealed it. But, you know, I also wanted to say, you know, the whole... one thing he did say, which I agreed with him, he said he doesn't think that Jeffrey Dahmer did anything wrong. And I definitely have to agree with him on that, because I have done extensive research on so many serial killers, white ones, because they're the ones who always come up. And one thing I've noticed about them is when they're committing all of these crimes like cannibalism and killing people and, you know, the bathing themselves in blood and all of these really sick things that they do, they actually say things like, you know, I just felt so normal. I felt so alive. I don't know if any of the listeners have heard of a man. He called Edmund Kemper. He was he first committed his first crime when he was 15. I think he shot his grandmother, then his parents, and he wasn't remorseful for that. He was locked up for about 5 years. They did a psychiatric evaluation of him, and they were like, oh, you know, he's obviously, he just got issues. We're going to have to release him and just keep a close eye on him. Anyway, he went on in the space of, I think, about 5 years to kill 8 females. I think one of them was non-white, but most of them were white females. But the reason why I'm mentioning him is because in his own words, he said this in the documentary that I watched. He said he had decapitated this woman's head, and he was looking at it, and he was talking to this head, and he was like, there's nothing wrong with me. My ancestors did this. You know, the Vikings, they did all of these kinds of things. There's nothing wrong with me. It's in my nature to do this. And I just thought I would quote him, because these white people, it's very natural for them to do these kind of things. It's I think it's harder for them to attempt to function as so-called normal, where they're not killing people, they're not doing all of these evil things. I think that's actually very difficult for them. But when they start, you know, going into, and if you want to look at certain things, like, for example, the things that they do in satanic rituals, like the guest mentioned it something today as well. He said killing someone at the climax of an orgasm, that's also satanic ritual, which supposed to grab the soul. Like, if you kill someone right at the time that you or that person were about to climax, then the killer then actually gets the soul from the person. And so it seems that white people can do a lot of these things really naturally. And I think that is the true nature. And to do anything else is actually what's difficult. Hmm. Yeah.
You're right about that, because if I can recall that movie with Stanley Kubrick, Eyes Wide Shut, if y'all recall that movie with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, when they dressed up in these masks and they had these orgies, and these, you know, these people were strangled almost to the point of death, where you were about ready to pass out before they go ahead and they release you. And some people, they said it gives them some kind of extra rush for them to climax when they're about to die, as you were having intercourse with them. And quite a few people have tried it, and they end up killing themselves, because it said once you get that first high, you can never match it. I guess it's like a drug dealer. When you take your first hit, you can never get that original first high. You can always try to match it, but it would never be the same. And people just kept going and going until they end up killing themselves. These are just sick people.
Anybody on the line that's on the call? I think this is Anella. You said you don't think Jeffrey Dahmer was crazy. Anybody on the line think he was quote unquote crazy?
No. Perfectly sane. Anyone who could go every day, you could go by your refrigerator, take something out to drink, put some sandwiches in there, leftover food, and you know you got human body up in there. You're not crazy. You know what you did. You put it in there. Then when it's all gone, you go and you find another body, you kill it, and then you put it all up in the, you eat some, put some in the refrigerator. That's not crazy.
A lot of these white killers, they're actually very intelligent people, and they know exactly what they're doing. They often know certain things that the average person doesn't know, which is what makes it so easy for them and makes them so successful in getting away with what they do for such a long time. I also did just want to mention as well, I don't know if anyone has ever heard of a man called Albert Fish. He, the story about him was he was a big-time cannibal as well. Google him. I haven't watched anything about him. I have read stuff about him. He was a white man who some people would say, I don't think so, but some people would say, I don't know, he looks like a typical friendly white man. That's how he was described. And the story about him was basically his first victim was a young girl. He literally just walked up to the parents' house and said, oh, yes, you know, I'm going to a party. Let me take your daughter with you. And, oh, you know, obviously trusting him because he was a white person, and they just gave up his daughter. Anyway, she didn't come back. Cutting a really long story short, she didn't come back, and they realized that he obviously killed her and ate her body too. But the thing about him is that there were other victims, and one of his victims, I know for a fact, was a black male child. And he actually talks about how he enjoyed, for example, cutting off his buttock cheeks, and eating them. Mm-hmm. And one thing that he did say as well, he said that his father was a 32nd degree Mason. And much of what he did, his father had taught him how to do. For him, it was just it was completely natural. There was nothing wrong with this. But I would advise all listeners, when you have time, really do your research. I mean, sometimes you're not always in the mood to watch and listen to some of the. You're not always in the mood to listen to like the gory details, but it's really, really important, because the more you do this, you understand like the real psyche of white people. And then you come to see the way I see white people is their normality, their level of sanity is complete dysfunction. So everything that, for example, black people, we know we're naturally inclined to think, oh, no, you can't do this. Obviously, we've been messed up now because of the current condition and what has happened to us. But all the things that we find to be just completely far from our nature, like this is what they embrace, this is what they do, or you'll be shocked to see. I mean, just for example, the amount of white people who own dogs who are actually indulging in sexual intercourse with their animals. Obviously, they'll never say this, but I strongly suggest any person who sees white people with dogs to just automatically think this person engaged in bestiality. They would never tell you that. They wouldn't do anything to make you think that. But from when you're letting a dog lick your face and all of these kind of things, I mean, come on, put two and two together. You know, so anyway, the point I don't want to keep on rambling on is white people's level of sanity is what we would call complete dysfunction. And by the way, I was wrong about Albert Fish. It wasn't his father who was a 32nd degree Mason. It was actually himself. So I've just been clarified on that point. So, yeah.
Well, it's just like the Norwegian killer. He was a very high, he was up there in the Masons that killed all of those people. And if you read the history of Albert Pike, who was the so-called founder of the Masons in America. He came out of the Ku Klux Klan, one of the founding members of the Klan. So, and if you look and see how they have distorted the so-called the mystery systems and converted it into this demonic thing that they are doing, you can understand why it is that a black person should not want to function or practice as a Mason.
Saw one of Albert Fish, one of his quotes. He's quoted as saying, "I like children. They are tasty."
Mm-hmm.
I think Ms. Zanelli, she has said before, perhaps the occult and white supremacy, two terms for the same concept.
Yeah. Because the term for the occult means meant what is hidden. That's what it means, the definition. But with these people, how they've corrupted all of the so-called ancient mysteries that they went and they have taken over, is that we as non-whites, we should not want to be a part of it, whether it be the Eastern Stars or whatever it is that they're running around here calling themselves. They all have to get chartered through the white system. Whichever club that you are functioning, you have to go through the white system in order to get to a chapter of whatever, even if it's the Prince Paul or whatever it is that you want to go to, you have to go to the white people. The same with the sororities and fraternity, you have to go to the white people in order to get you a charter.
I'll ask some of the folks that are on the line, and if anybody else, the folks that are listening in, talk shoe, star 8. If you're on the free HD line, that's star 6 to put your hand up if you have a question or comment. The guest, white man, suspected racist, Robert Dvorak, he said, Dahmer, he had a highly refined predator's radar in being able to seek out victims, people that he knew he could take advantage of and manipulate. And since most of his victims were black males, I was just going to get you all's comments on what that says about us, black people.
Our level of trust in white people, that's what it says, that the white people have conditioned us to such a point that they know they could show up and we would not suspect them, but the minute we see a black person, we would snatch our purses, lock our car doors or whatever, because we feel more scared of being around our own, and we feel so disarmed and safe being around white people, when it should be the opposite, judging by our history with them. But if you read all of these surveys that they do, people say all the time, if they go down a dark street and they see a black person approaching them, a black male, they immediately get apprehensive, and this is coming from black people. But if they see a white person, they don't feel as apprehensive when they see a white person on a dark, lonely street. And that could be Jeffrey Dahmer. Isn't that the same thing that Adams was saying, that he was saying, "Oh, black people, we're not scared of them, but we are more scared of being around our own," and some black people do feel that way.
Absolutely.
You know, I just wanted to add that in relation to white people, I definitely, again, have to agree with the guest. They have a natural radar that allows them. You don't have to say anything to white people, and I've experienced this time and time again. They can just look at you, and depending on how you look at them, if you speak to them, sometimes how you're dressed, how you're conducting yourself before you've noticed that there's no issue. So many different things come into play. They already know whether they can fool you or not. And the response I get with white people is, I'm always getting dirty looks. I don't smile at them. You know, they can't talk to me. White people don't even attempt to say anything to me. They just know naturally when you're going to be accepting to them or not. And this is something I think that would have been easy for Jeffrey Dahmer to have done. Gus, I wanted to know if it's okay if I could play a sound clip for all the listeners. This is about the Jeffrey Dahmer's killer. It's about a minute long. You can get some other callers on before I play the sound clip, but just something that I think will be interesting for listeners. But you can give me your feedback.
We can play it if you – I'm just thinking for clarity's sake. If you think it's important just for clarity, I don't have – same thing I was telling Justice yesterday. I don't have the cable to play it live, but if you find it, right, if it's on YouTube or if it's online someplace and it's only a minute, if you send it to me, I might be able to record it and upload it so it'll be clearer, just so that it won't have any distortion in it or what have you, so everybody can hear clearly what's being said. Is it on YouTube or where is the sound clip at?
It's on a website. Hold on, I'm going to have to leave it. If you can just hold on, if you just take another caller, I can answer in a second.
Okay. The person calling in from California with a hand up on the talk show line, your line is open as well.
Yeah, hello. Very interesting show. Wow. Yeah, you know, it's all about the relative, you know, like the mindset of, you know, like everyone that, you know, came, that went some, all those white people that, you know, went elsewhere from where they're from and then just did whatever they wanted, which was, you know, a lot of, you know, sex, gay sex and just sex in general and just mutilating people and then just, you know, hiding behind a flag or, you know, in this case, not. But, yeah, I mean, in my experience, you know, I went to school with white people, you know, elementary school, and I'm you know, quote-unquote black, you know, so-called black male. But, you know, now I'm kind of, like, it's just pretty amazing just to reflect on the basis of our society and how we're standing next to, you know, we're integrated into this, you know, community of people who are probably, you know, who probably want us all dead or they brought, you know, it's kind of, it's just eye-opening, and I appreciate the, you know, thoughtfulness and everything of what the information you guys are presenting. Yeah. Like I've experienced, like, you know, victims will react, you know, to their victimization, and I've experienced that. As that, you know, a victim lashing out and like, all right, that's what that is. But then, like, white people are coming from a whole different place, and it's a, you know, just, it's very important to be aware of that, you know, just to keep yourself alive, you know, at some point. Like, yeah, so.
There was one other person that called in. I wanted to open their line up as well. I was just reminded, like I said, I would encourage folks. It is grisly. I'll make sure I get that out. It's a lot of the documentaries are very gruesome. They have photographs of some of the black victims that he's carved up. And I mean, just some of the worst stuff that you could ever see. But it is extremely informative. Just to get a better understanding, this is white people. This is not anomalous. This is Jeffrey Dahmer. This is Anders Behring Breivik. This is white people. This is how they get down. This is just varying degrees. From time to time, this sort of thing happens in mass. Other times, they try and keep this on the hush. But this is how white people get down. Just have that in mind. The person who dialed in, it's just on a number. If you dialed in with the number 5 on TalkShoe, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah. Hey, Gus. I just wanted to call and give commentary. I thought that it was an excellent show. And,
is this Miss White?
I was wondering if anybody heard about. Hello?
I was just. Is this? I didn't
Hello?
Want
to. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Is this the person responsible for our wonderful graphics?
Yes. This is
right
Brian Greenbell.
Right on. Give them the website too. Sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no problem. That's TRIMultimedia.com. Thank you for the plug. I'm enjoying the dialogue, and you know, I think that we, you know, I try to magnify the psychotic and sadistic and sociopathic nature of white people all of the time. And I was wondering if anyone had heard of that one organization that Thomas Jefferson was a part of, that Hellfire Club. Thomas Jefferson and some others were part of an organization back in England where they would have orgies and sacrifices and all kinds of stuff. On the off, they would break into churches and vandalize them and drink blood. I mean, I just noticed that any time that they have access, you know, they always take it to another level. You know, if they have money and they have access, then they start pedophilia rings, or, you know, they're secretly sacrificing kids, or I definitely think we should increase awareness about that.
Where can you get information on this club that Jefferson was a part of?
If you just put in, let me look online, because I have pulled up the website, and I think that the History Channel, the first time I heard about it, it was a documentary, and the History Channel had mentioned it, because it was him, and it was another guy, I'm trying to think of his name, but just do research on Hellfire Club. It's like an elitist type upper class, you know, in the 1700s, something that, you know, a secret society type thing that white people could join and, you know, do their sick psychotic white people thing. And he was like a member. I'm trying to think of the other white historical figure. Alexander Hamilton was also a member. It's crazy.
And this was conducted in Europe, this club.
I'm sorry?
The club was headquartered in Europe, or did they bring a branch of it here to the U.S.?
No, this is when he was in Europe. I think that it was before he came to the United States. But, when they were talking about the stuff that these people used to do, I'm like, man, how do you go from, but it's always like, the politicians and I think the barons of back in the day, you know, it's always upper class, a lot of money, a lot of access, and then they have these things and they take these things and do something satanic with it, like every time.
You're giving me some homework.
I always try and bring it to the forefront because, you know, I think that, you know, I found in conversations that I have, you know, I will bring stuff like this up at my job on purpose. And, you know, they always seem to have a hard time defending that. You know, I don't think that Caucasians are as codified when it comes to their sick, sadistic, you know, they're you know, when you put it a certain way, I don't think, you know, they're as codified with that. So I try to attack that with them.
Well, as you said, they tie sex with pleasure, pain, blood, all of that, they tie that stuff into. So it would not surprise me. I guess that's why when Sally Hemings was taken over there and he was raping her at the age of 12 and 13. People like to talk about these so-called founding fathers.
I'm not surprised. I definitely look at them as beings that were put here on the earth to epitomize and to manifest evil, you know, for the rest of the universe, for us to get an understanding of what evil is. I think that these people were put here to be that example. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong.
Marquis de Sade. All that.
Look at all of their history. Look at what they did with the Inquisition. Now, who would want to put somebody in a rack and stretch them? And all this crazy stuff that they come with all kind of inventive ways of torturing and killing people.
Now it's like we're in this age of like where all this information is exposed. Like it's all, you know, all this mainstream movies, every movie. You know, I mean, in the 90s more, I haven't really been watching too many movies since, like, you know, early 2000s and 90s, but it seemed like every other movie is like a Pelican Brief or, like, you know, all these political, like, or, you know, sexual, like, you know, little clubs, little, you know, boy, men, you know, white guys club, like, where they're doing all this crap, and then some white guy is going to, like, find out about it and expose it, and then, like, it's all going to get kind of swept under the carpet, but you're going to be like, oh, well, at least, you know, these white people are trying to help, but it's, like, in the end, it's just, like, the whole thing is, like, exposing scapegoat, you know, instead of exposing the culture for itself, they expose one person and say, that's the culture, and look, it's gone now, you know. We got Tom Cruise, he's a hero, you know. Like,
I'd just like to say one thing that I see white people do. Whenever the topic is positive things that people, that non-white people have done, white people want to step in and assume full credit for that. But whenever the topic turns to pathologies exhibited by white people are always quick to say that all of humanity has the same tendency to do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There
human
are
nature.
Animals in every race. There are homosexuals in nature. But they skirt over the fact that they build societies off of pathology when you study the history. So their entire society is built on protecting a pathological institution. Just what they're doing right now with homosexuality, they're willing to use war to institute a pathology on societies all around the world. So this is a tendency you notice white people do. And a couple of days ago when Gus had the white supremacist on the show, I was just reminded of Dr. Booker T. Coleman's analysis on white people when he says they have this arrogant ignorance. So when discussing history, he'll throw a non-truth out. When you knock that non-truth down with factual, hardcore, irrefutable truth, then he says history does not matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't care about history. But if you have a tree that's dropping apples, does it change the fact that that tree once started as a seed that was planted in the past? So the past is the present, only the present is more a refined version of the past. They're the same. But white people love to disconnect the past from the present when it suits their ability to confuse whoever they're talking to. And with that, I'll just continue to listen.
But you're right, because that's the same thing with this Adam's character that came on Gus's show a couple shows ago that was sprouting his nonsense about sociology and who is human and what is the nature of black people. And he's not well-versed. He's not well-learned. He wants to, like you said, they want to pull out all the good in society and put it in their column. Okay, this is the white column. And whatever bad is out here, then it's a collective. But all people do these things. And all of a sudden now that they want to say, well, white people were in Egypt. This sounds like he's studying on the Mary Leftwich, who's out there, I believe she's at I forgot what college she is out there in the Northeast that was pushing this foolishness. I never set foot in Egypt. And she's talking about white people were in Egypt. And Dr. Clark had to put her in her place because he said, have you been there? She's never been there. She's been studying in Greece. It's all her history's in Greece. And all of a sudden she's going to make a leap from there to say that these Greeks were actually Egyptians. And that's the same thing this person is making.
You know, the thing about the guests yesterday, I don't doubt for a second that he didn't know most of the information that people were telling him. I think it's part of the arrogance of knowing that the world is dominated by white supremacy. The information that white supremacists, for the most part, put out to everyone else, he can repeat that and say, well, that's what I've been told. That's what, for the most part, most non-white people think. So what are you going to do about it? Because if someone gets into a show like yesterday and they're very confused, they're more likely to believe him because they'll be like, no, but he's right because I have seen that. And, you know, it's a bit, even with basic research, you can get, you know, the true facts, but white supremacists conceal it. So for the average confused person, they'll probably find the lie first. And then if a white person says that, they'll believe it. So I don't even think for a second that he doesn't know.
That's the reason why they're trying to get rid of, shut down all of these black bookstores and black publishers, because too much knowledge was given out within the past 50 to 60 years, and they want to stem the flow and push it back to where it was in slavery days. So these people are going in a real panic, and they're trying to shut it down real quick, pulling the black studies, African American studies or Africana studies out of the colleges and universities. They're really shutting it down real quick.
I wanted to just make sure I got.
I understand why. They have a self-esteem, a built-in self-esteem booster, because I look at the system of white supremacy as, I mean, it serves many purposes for white people, but it's definitely something to boost the self-esteem of white people around the globe. And it's built in deception, and they have to defend deception. They're mad. They're masters at working within deception, and they have to, because their self-esteem, their patriotism and their pride, it all lies within this deception. So they're adamant about, perpetuating that, even when they know that it's false. Like, I wholeheartedly agree with Zanelle when she said that she thinks that the white man that was on tonight, he consciously lied about that being a white man. I mean, this is someone who has written a book, well-researched this issue, and, for his life to end, in this climax of murder in prison, I mean, that's just a fact that, it sticks out, it's burned and etched into your mind and your memory. There's no way that you can box that fact that it was a black man that killed him. So I wholeheartedly agree with her, and that's just more of that self-esteem and that defense mechanism that white people have. I think you just had a guest on the show who said that he has to lie. He can't go into a situation telling the truth at all. He was just straightforward with it. Like,
Guest yesterday, Reverend, and he was a Reverend David Billings. That didn't even really stick out to me too much. But this is the Reverend saying, yes, when I go to non-white people, it's a psychological motivation for me to lie to them and to try to convince them. Oh, okay. And to try to convince them that I'm not a racist when I know that that's not true. He just said that the Reverend David Billings. I also wanted to make sure that I got Zanelli's point about, I think white people are very informed. White people make it their business to be informed about people that they're going to victimize. Same with Jeffrey Dahmer. They study their victims. They have studied black people well. They know what we've done. They've stolen most of what we've done and tried to claim it for their own. I don't believe the problem is that, people like Joe, who was on the program Sunday, I don't believe the problem is that they are ignorant about these things. I believe the problem is that they are racist. They don't care what we've done. That means nothing to them. To them, it's all about, we're going to keep our foot on these niggers forever, raping them, whatever else we want to do. It's not that they're ignorant. It's not that they don't have this information. I just wanted to make sure that I got that out. I got the article or the video, Ms. Zanelli. I'm recording it, and I'll upload it so we can play it as the program. When we get ready to wrap up, I'll play it for the conclusion of the program. There we go.
Well, like you said, what Tom was inventing the wheel, that they invent the wheel. I don't know where he got his information that they invented a wheel, because as recently as 800 years ago, these people were illiterate. So all of a sudden that they were inventing things and writing books, and they could barely scratch an X in the dirt. But it's a good thing that, Gus, you're having these white guests come on the show, because we need to get a dose, a reminder, before we get very, very comfortable. Exactly what's still out here.
I said that for a long time. I always enjoy having white people on the program. Don't get me wrong. I love having Mr. Fuller on, Dr. Welsing, Dr. Rossayon. He'll be back this weekend. But I always love having white people on. I think it's constructive. And again, just if you need a reminder, the problem is white people, and really just being, you know, on the ball about paying attention to what they have to say. Even the person today, I think he had constructive information, but just being on the ball, that slip in at the end, well, I won't say slip, but the incorrect information at the end, where I suspect him practicing white supremacy deliberately and saying that it was a white person who killed Jeffrey Dahmer. Always got to be on your guard. You got to have non-white people. We need to get our radar correct with regards to white people. That, I think, would help balance out the equation.
It just goes to show with religion and lies that these people, if he can so readily go before an audience and have his collar on and deliberately lie to them, so he should tell you the whole concept of whatever it is that these so-called people of the cloth are telling you, you need to take it with a grain of sand.
We got about 7 minutes left in the broadcast. We were on a little bit earlier today. Anything, the folks that are on the line, if you called in, anything you all want to share before we wrap up, or if there's anybody listening, if you want to share anything before the program concludes, the number to dial, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. If you're on that line, just press *6. If you have questions, if you're on the talk show line, it's *8, and I will make sure I get in again. Thank you, Black Megatroid, because this program wouldn't have happened if I didn't get a friendly reminder. Thank you, Black Megatroid.
Well, I just want to say that I started pointing out to a lot of my friends who have young kids who are, you know, involved in various things at school, or they involved in sports or whatever it is, you know, and I've been trying to increase awareness as far as, you know, just giving these people open access and open reign to your kids, and just handing them over and let after practice, they want to go and have pizza and, you know, all of these various things. I've really been trying to, you know, just keep people, put people on alert. Like, you know, maybe you should think about the kind of time you allow your children to spend with white people, children, but especially adults. I mean, you know, I've been really trying to get that word out. So if you all know any people with kids, because I feel like with children, when white people come into our lives and they can help us in some sort of way, whether it be financially or whatever it is, you know, as far as the school system, I've just seen Black people totally put their guards down and allow their children to just, you know, go to the game or go with these white people. And that's another reason why I always try and bring up their psychotic, you know, sadistic history and nature. Like, you know, I think we need to be on alert with that a little more. I think we sleep when it comes to just letting these people run off with our kids and have sleepovers and camping trips, and, man, it's crazy.
You're right about that, because it's like Gus did a show a while back with a Little Rock 9 where he was talking about some of the women in particular. One of the women that was chased down by a white man to be raped, and she ended up marrying all a white person. And I was going back through the women who were part of the 9, and more than half of them end up marrying to white men. So it just goes to show the psychosis of people. As you said, after going through such a traumatic experience, that they still find white people to be more desirable and trusting to form lasting relationships with.
The person who called in just one on the talk show line, your line should be open. I got that sound clip. Mr. Nelly will play it We should have about another 7 minutes, and then we'll get the sound clip. The person who called in just one, your line should be open. I'm also reminded, I told y'all, that footage, you should really do research on Jeffrey Dahmer. You'll learn a lot. There's a footage in one of the documentaries where they have a black male who knew Jeffrey Dahmer. I guess he used to hang out at one of the spots where Jeffrey Dahmer would stalk his victims. And he said, I didn't like Dahmer. I remember we just didn't get along. He said, I'm so glad that I didn't like him because I probably would have had my head in the refrigerator too. And, I mean, that image just, man. Anyway, person who called in, just one, your line should be open. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I just want to say that one thing I noticed with white people, especially with the guy that you had on the other day named Joe, they like to pick and choose certain things in their history to take credit for. Like, I noticed that he wanted to take credit. He was quick to take credit for the composers like Mozart and Bach and people like that. But as soon as you brought up slavery, he was just like, oh, well, that wasn't me. But you also didn't compose that music. So, like, every time you attack them with that, with things like logic like that, they can't really take it. And I really wish I could have spoke to him that day because I wanted to bring up a lot of things.
You're right, because if he had studied his history, he was calling Beethoven and Mozart, he would realize that those were mulattoes, and he was saying that they were white.
Yep.
Apparently, he didn't do his history.
Yep.
But,
Pushkin, who gave...
Bach,
oh, sorry, you
couldn't Beethoven
ahead.
And Bach be the same as, let's say, Elvis Presley or Justin Timberlake? Remember,
yep.
There were Moors in Europe, and and they influenced a lot of their music. That's why they haven't really evolved from Bach and Beethoven in 200 years when they kicked the Moors out of Europe. So it could be said that as it is today, as it was yesterday.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And another thing I noticed is that everything great that black people and non-white people do, they like to say it's acting white or they're taken from white people. But whenever it's bad things that black people do, they just say that they're acting black. Why can't that be acting white as well, since they supposedly learn everything from you when it comes to war and violence and gangs, which you were the true gang members? So why isn't that acting white? Think about that.
Well, we need to Pushkin. Because Pushkin is the one that gave Russia the language. Russia was speaking French before they got that dialect that they are currently speaking. And Alexander Pushkin, a man descended from Africans, who gave them the language.
Yep, and I live in Philly right now, and I'm originally from Detroit. And I noticed a lot of Philadelphians, no matter what race, which is, I don't like to use that word because there's a lot of, because it's only one race, and it's just various ethnicities, but no matter who the people are, they all have a certain slang they use. Even white people talk a certain slang. So when you look at other people speaking like them, they basically got the slang from them. So a lot of black people, came from the South, and they heard slang probably from, white people. And so when you think of black people using slang, where do you think they got slang from?
It's not only that, but if they study their history, the overseers and the slave drivers who were on the plantation, they were uneducated, backward, non-writing white people that came fresh off the boat from Europe. Couldn't speak the king's English or the queen's English or whatever English. So that's who the slaves patterned themselves after, because those are the people that they were exposed to, those type of whites, the uncultured whites. So if black people have to speak the language bad, who we got it from?
Yep, and we all know that all culture, so-called culture, but Neely Fuller, he said it the right way. Culture is whatever you do at the time that you're doing it. All culture, I mean, at least the great cultures and also a lot of history and knowledge came from Africa. So whenever a black person is being astute, educated, and proper, they're acting African, not white. Whenever a black person is mistreating people or a black person is using slang and being violent and all those other traits, they're acting white. That's how I look at it.
Ms. Zanelli, did you want to get anything in before we get to the sound clip to conclude the program? Always good to hear our folks from other part of the world, Plantation. Ms. Zanelli?
No, I was just listening to everyone else. Always a good show. And just my final comment, it's always really good to hear white people on the show because it's teaching me a lot. Before, I used to prefer hearing the black guests only, but as time is getting on, I'm feeling that it's really, really important to hear from these white people.
Sure. More white people coming. More white people coming. We'll be back on Friday doing a program. I haven't done a program by myself in a long time. Doing a program this Friday. Just to kind of touch on some of the things that Joe shared from Save White People and skills I think are important to hone. When you talk to racist man and racist woman, folks can call and share their views, but that'll be this Friday evening. Should be 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, a little bit later, not too late, but it'll be Friday. Hopefully people can hang late if they want to listen live. Dr. Rossione, Miana Rossione, he'll be making his third trip this Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern. He wanted to talk about MSNBC. They did a report on white people victimizing black children in Mali, and they have a video. I'll put it on my Facebook page. It's like 17 minutes. But they go, it's just white people clowning. Same thing they've been doing for 200 years. Oh, look at the poor, starving black people. They have to work so hard. Oh, this is terrible. Just more foolishness. But he wanted to talk about that specifically and his other book. He's written two books. We talked about his Melanin Manual the first time around. This time we'll be talking about The Awakening, all related to racism, white supremacy, but that'll be this weekend. One of our other listeners, long-time listener, she emailed then. She just wanted to share more on white people's pathology. She wrote, Ted Bundy, he raped and bit some of the white females that he killed. John Wayne Gacy, he wore his mother's panties as a child. The anti-sexual killed young white males. The Hillside Strangler, he raped and killed prostitutes. Elizabeth Bathory, Countess Dracula, I guess her alias. She was an anti-sexual white female. She killed and tortured young white females. Jack the Ripper, killer of white female prostitutes. Ed Gein, cannibal, white female killer, made household items out of the body parts of his prey. She writes also the movie Psycho was based on his life. He was from La Crosse, Wisconsin. That's so funny, where the White Privilege Conference was last year. All about necrophilia. They had statues all over La Crosse, Wisconsin, of Native Americans playing the game lacrosse. All necrophilia. We've killed them and taken their game over. She also writes, Dennis Rader, BTK Bind. He would bind, torture, and kill females by strangulation, sexual gratification with some of his kills. Myra Henley and Ian Brady raped white children, and Myra Henley, she would take turns killing the children. Her final comment, Jeffrey Dahmer wasn't insane. He knew how to lie in order to not be caught. As for his victims, we trust white folks more than too much. Very important. We trust white folks more than too much. I'm going to actually change my mind. I was going to play the video to end, but this is all kind of too grisly a note to end on, so I prefer to end with a prayer. I think that would be more fitting to have a prayer to help deal with all of the horrible pathology that white people exude daily. I will play the sound clip just for the evidence that the killer of Jeffrey Dahmer is indeed a black male, and then after that, do we have anybody that wants to do the prayer today? If nobody wants to do it, I'll do it. Anybody, any volunteers want to do the prayer today?
I think I'll do it.
Okay. Groovy. Hang tight. We will do the sound clip, courtesy of Ms. Zanelli and her partner. Thank you for the hard work. Oh, make sure your partner, thank you. That was his suggestion to get back to asking white people to put their money where their anti-racist claim is. He motivated me to ask the white person, Reverend Billings, on the program yesterday, who said he'd be down to invest $100 in Dr. Kamara, his school down in Louisiana. Thank you to Ms. Zanelli and her black partner. I will play the sound clip, and then once that's done, we will do our prayer to wrap things up. Again, we'll be back this Friday evening. Please share the links to the program if you think it's constructive, if you think this would benefit non-white people to hear the content. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Thank you to everybody who has invested to keep things rolling. CynicalAfrican.wordpress.com. Sir Anton, he's on the line today. His website, CafePress.com/creative concepts, Cree Counter Racist Evolving Engineer. It's Cree7.wordpress.com. And D-Train, Vickers, Reckless 2.0, excellent counter racist programming. Thank you, everybody, for all the listeners, callers, keeps things rolling. Really wouldn't be able to do it without you all. Non Mighty Wick, Back of the Bus, Yellow Manny, long list of folks. Thanks, everybody. All right, we'll do the sound clip, and then as soon as that's over, we will get the prayer from our listener. This is just evidencing Jeffrey Dahmer's killer was indeed a black male.
You attend our special coverage of Jeffrey Dahmer's legacy of terror. It's been 20 years since Dahmer's arrest for the grotesque murders of 17 men. It was a story that took unbelievable twists and turns and changed Milwaukee forever. 3 years after he was arrested, Jeffrey Dahmer was murdered in prison.
But there are still questions about whether the man who killed him acted alone. Christopher Scarver has sent me several letters recently. Tonight, we see those letters from a killer.
Jeffrey Dahmer, the nation's most notorious serial killer. He tortured and murdered 17 young men and boys and then had sex with their bodies. Sentenced to 957 years in prison, the mild-mannered Dahmer instantly became Wisconsin's most famous inmate, sought out by the news media, which was fascinated with his bizarre crimes. Dahmer calmly told Dateline NBC he still had an urge to kill.
It never completely goes away. I'll probably have to live with it for the rest of my life.
Dahmer's life at Columbia Correctional lasted less than 3 years, in part because he was placed in the general inmate population. Another prisoner, armed with a steel bar, beat him to death in November of 1994. That inmate was 25-year-old Christopher Scarver of Milwaukee. Scarver was serving a life sentence for murder when he decided to kill Dahmer and another notorious prisoner named Jesse Anderson. Anderson had stabbed his wife to death in the parking lot at Northridge Mall. The Cedarburg man falsely blamed two black men. Somehow, Scarver, Dahmer, and Anderson were assigned to cleaning duty together. A guard escorted them to the gym and inexplicably left them alone. Dahmer started cleaning the men's room. Anderson cleaned the locker room, and Scarver went to the weight room. Scarver took a steel bar from a dumbbell and went into the men's room and beat Dahmer beyond recognition. Then he went to the locker room and beat Anderson. Scarver calmly walked back to his cell and told a guard, "God told me to do it." You will hear about it on the 6 o'clock news. Jesse Anderson and Jeffrey Dahmer are dead. At his first court appearance, Scarver entered the courtroom singing.
Rain or shine, sharing your dreams, your heart and your mind.
Initially, Scarver entered an insanity plea, but eventually he pled no contest.
Your parole eligibility date will not be until the year 3077.
Because of his notoriety, Scarver was shipped to a prison outside Wisconsin. He's been bounced around to several maximum security prisons over the years and is currently at a prison in Colorado that houses the most disruptive offenders. Scarver has sent me several letters in recent months. His grammar is flawless, which is somewhat surprising considering he's a high school dropout who has spent half of his life in prison. He writes, "It took me 16 years to work my way out of the hole, 24-hour-a-day solitary confinement for that 1994 event. I was finally released into the general prison population on November 8th, 2010. Scarver claims that Colorado prison officials will not let him practice his religion, Hinduism.
Unfortunately, I was put back in the hole on February 4th, 2011, simply because I requested my religious needs. 20 years after Dahmer's arrest here near 25th and State, questions remain about Dahmer's murder. Did Christopher Scarver act alone? Did guards look the other way, allowing Scarver to kill Dahmer? 4 months before Dahmer was murdered, another prisoner tried to kill him but failed. A few weeks later, an informant warned prison officials that Scarver was now planning to kill Dahmer. That old boy Dahmer is going to get it again. There were other inmates involved. They were supposed to create a distraction, but that tip was ignored. A Blue Ribbon panel investigated Dahmer's murder. They interviewed Scarver and concluded Scarver acted alone. He was not part of a conspiracy. The attack was not racially motivated. Scarver found both Dahmer and Anderson unfit to live. In my exchange of letters, I asked Scarver about the attack. Why? How? Did anyone else help? He has yet to answer those questions. In his most recent response, he wrote, "I'm in the hole again." Respectfully, humbly, sincerely, Christopher J. Scarver, Deep Segregation, B1. Christopher Scarver is such a high-security inmate that prison officials in Colorado will not even confirm that he is in their custody, despite the fact that he has sent me all of these letters. Now, if Scarver ever does answer my questions, it could finally end the debate over whether Christopher Scarver acted alone when he killed Jeffrey Dahmer and Jesse Anderson.
That is the conclusion of the sound clip. Thank you very much, Ms. Zanelle. See, told you all, lots of great information studying the Jeffrey Dahmer case. My email address is untiljustice@gmail.com. If anybody should need to email me for anything. The caller who said they were going to do the prayer, take it away. We'll be back. Yep. I'm signing out, so we'll be done when you finish up. We'll be back this Friday evening. Caller, take it away.
Okay. I would like the Creator to give non-white people the clarity to see who and what the problem is that is plaguing the entire universe. I would also like for the Creator to give non-white people all over the entire universe the energy and the steadfastness to help and to continue to work towards destroying the most malicious and the most unjust system the universe has ever known. Amen.
Amen.
Right on.
Context of white supremacy signing out. Thank you all for tuning in.